there's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
So my boys,
what? Okay, folks, so an unconventional live stream episode of the Survival Podcast. I'm Jack Spierko for those on Matt's channel, and that, of course, is Matt Powers for those on Matt's channel and for those on mine. And we're going to do things a little bit differently today. Matt and I have talked a lot over the years on and off about different things to do with soil. I come at this from a perspective of just an entrepreneur who decided to be a farmer, who built a little duck farm and started making different types of compost, playing with cover crops, playing with biochar and things like that. And Matt comes at this, what I would refer to Matt as a citizen scientist. Matt breaks out the microscope, actually understands what's going on, and also very big into the Korean natural farming, Japanese natural farming stuff with IMOs. And the interesting thing to me is over about a decade, we came from very different perspectives, and we kind of have ended up in the same place by different mechanisms. And so what I'd like to do for my audience who may not know you that well, Matt, is can you just tell us, like, I know at one time you were a school teacher, and now you're like this crazy renegade soil scientist. The elevator version, how does that look? How does that happen?
I just kind of kept serving the needs of the students. And it went from permaculture to entrepreneurism to soil science and then the testing for soil science. Because soil is the linchpin to everything we do in permaculture, it became the failure point for almost every single like problem that I encountered from my students. Once they got the topographic map down, which is the most common permaculture, you know, PDC failure point. But yeah, it was soil that I just kept getting deeper and more curious. And I kept seeing these open, just kind of like laying there obvious to me. And I'm like, hey, you guys see this? You guys ever pH test your compost? And everyone's like, no. I'm like, oh, you guys thought about that? And they're like, huh. And then they all test it and it's all pH 8. And they're like, oh, that's not what I want. Yeah. And so I keep seeing these things. This right here, this I was able to use a new technology, a new LED light that is unique. It was all mercury lamps before that, to see the fungi that partners with over 90% of plants in such a way that we can characterize where it's at in its life cycle and how much phosphorus it's pumping into the plant. So when people talk about like peak phosphorus, and I know that's like a popular, like, you know, mainstream media fear tactic thing.
Yep.
It's just that. It's a fear tactic. It's not real. Natural farming has exposed how nature works and how we just need to partner with those cycles and incredible things can happen. So I've been doing my part to debunk and open up and create clarity in this space. And it very much so is like I'm still in the classroom where I'm just trying to help the students accomplish their goals.
But you don't have a school board and an administrative staff telling you what you're allowed to do anymore.
Right. Yeah. Banning.
And I do say we have walked these very similar but different paths, right? Because I'm a teacher today is the way I look at it more than anything else that I do. I'm also a journalist, depending on what we're covering on any given day. But the primary thing I do is teach, completely unencumbered by any sort of oversight other than if my people leave me, then I'm screwed, right? So as long as I do a good job for my people, it works out all right. But like for your folks that are listening in today or later with this video being post-published, when I started out and I found permaculture, and I was always a gardener. I grew up as a gardener. We subsistence gardened. Like we grew food so we had food to eat. Like that level of thing in rural Pennsylvania, we grew up hunting, fishing, and gardening for food, not for hobbies, not for something to do. And I thought I was pretty good at it. And then I discovered permaculture. And while my grandfather did a lot of things in a natural way, he also would use, you know, some 10-10-10 fertilizer to boost the plants in the middle and stuff like that. And because we were in like the richest, most, you know, forgiving climate in the world, which is zone 6 in central Pennsylvania, it just doesn't get better. it really never catastrophically failed, but I also saw that it was never as good as it could be, right? And so I got better at doing it kind of an organic way, and then I started, and when I rediscovered that, I was living in Pennsylvania myself. I moved back here to Texas and carried on with that. Then I started this show. People emailed me, like, Jeff Lawton's Greening the Desert and some videos of Bill Mollison, early day videos, and I'm like, wow, so just basically work with nature and don't do anything. And then, like, the blister beetle came and completely devoured all my watermelon and all my, like, nothing left. And I'm like, okay, so there has to be something in the middle of this. And at the same time, I would look out at nature and I would go, that forest over there, that glade over there, that, you know, that savanna system over there, these things are thriving and nobody does anything. And then there was this disconnect of, like, why doesn't this concept of do nothing work? You know, and then I discovered, like, Fukuoka, and it's like, so do nothing actually has a lot of doing in it. Like, there's a lot of stuff to do. It's just doing something different and being more patient. And that kind of led me to the idea that these plants are growing in the soil. That's where they're actually getting everything that they need. So let's address that. And that's when I got into, like, the bioactive composting, the biochar, and cover cropping. And the cover cropping is the thing that has blown my mind more than anything else, because we've been trained, and it's not taught, because taught is different than training. I can train a plant. I can train a slime mold. I can train a dog, right? But I can teach a dog, but I can't teach a slime mold or a tree, right? So right. We have been trained, in other words, conditioned to have a specific response that when we grow plants, we deplete soil. That's the mindset that all modern agriculture comes from, that when I put plants in the ground, the soil will be worse at the end of that growing season. And it can be if you do everything in a messed up way.
Yeah.
But the key to actually building bioactive soil is to grow as much in it as you can. Like, to never let that soil be absent living roots. And when I understood that, I realized, like, until we get down to this concept of everything is really like 90% biological and 10% chemical as far as we need to address as growers. And until we get to that point, we can never fix this system because we're doing it the wrong way. Like, we're trying to go to the moon, but we're pointing the rocket at the other direction from where the moon is and going, I don't understand. Like, that's how the whole thing feels to me now.
Yeah, it's that kind of fundamental misconception. There's a lot of those currently in our world. Soil is no different. You know, when they talk about how something can trick you when they do certain tests, and they're like, oh, well, this is not replicable. There's so much of that. There's so much of, like, microscopy. If you look at a lot of these published papers, the images, they're kind of terrible. And you're like, why are, because they don't want you to be able to verify or argue with them. Because if it's a fudged image, you just got to take their word for it.
And well, and I look at some of your images, and I know you made a major investment in your equipment, but compared to the resources of, let's say, a university laboratory funded by all these giant companies or these governmental organizations with giant, they could afford better equipment than you have, but for some reason, when they publish data, they never do.
Yeah, yeah, it's a game they're playing, essentially. They're being funded to get certain answers. The people that come out of it feel suffocated, and it's wild. You know, in mycology, in the natural farming movement, you talk to people, they're like, yeah, I used to work for NASA. And you're like, wait, what? They're like, yeah, I just grow mushrooms now. And I'm like, really? They're like, yeah, I just couldn't handle, like, the moral and ethical side of it. It's like, oh. And so it's like we're brain draining all these terrible institutions, and we're building independence. We're building all this because it's the real science. Citizen science is taking off because A, the things are becoming less expensive, but B, because the emperor wears no clothes right now. Mm-hmm. And so you're like, is CO2 such a bad thing? Well, Nebraska and Iowa farmers who have done their testing realize that in the middle of when it's just cornfields everywhere and no compost and no engines, really, because they already did that part, there's no CO2 being created. It's all oxygen. And so from, you know what I mean, when people test, there's a much more complex world that opens up. And the same thing is true of all these aspects of soil. We need the carbon back in the soil, absolutely. But we also need to understand the primary mechanism for that is plants. A field of corn takes up 400 times the ambient increase in CO2 every season. But it's how we handle the soil, how we till the soil, how we desiccate all those plants that gases off all that carbon. And it's also carbon is the backbone for holding all the nutrients, all the moisture in the soil and buffering between your nutrients. Some things are antagonistic. So there's been this game where they've taken half-truths and bits and pieces and cobbled together these narratives, and it's screwed up our farmers. It's screwed up the gardeners. It's screwed up the internet. And the reality is we all can just do the work and see for ourselves. And so I ask the fundamental question, what's most natural here? And how can I verify that's true? And so, yeah.
Go ahead.
So my whole mission with creating regenerative soil was to create the micro to macro, all the microbes and getting down to where chemistry and biology meet. It's called, microbiology. They literally are the chemists. And when you get down to there, people get very overwhelmed by the complexity, but there's dominances. And so when you can actually map those things out, and I have, and scale them up to hands-on action that actually affects those things positively or negatively, depending on what you want to do, because you might want to show people what they're doing is wrong and why, right? They show all of it. And yeah. So once you understand how your hands-on affects the microscopic world and your soil and your plants, you make better choices. And when you make better choices and see those better results, it changes everything. And you can see those results with the microscope. You can see those results with mineral testing as well. They test different things. They see different things. And so I've combined them into a discipline that allows us to make faster decisions, more informed decisions, and people are doubling their yields. People are getting rid of blight, pests, insects, locusts, you know what I mean? All of the above. They're being able to combat all these incredibly, I mean, if you look at their neighbors, insurmountable problems. And it's all really just common sense once you understand the sense of nature and the sense of soil. And that's all I do is I set up a picture frame so that micro to macro relationship becomes clear, and we can interact with it and see our actions more clearly. Because once we see our actions more clearly, we're like, that was no more nitrogen. Oh my gosh. You know, and once you see yourself clearly, you make great decisions. People are incredible that way. When they have the right information, they make good decisions. There's so much deception in the world today that people are thirsty for truth and replication and verifiability. And that's what this offers, and that's what I do.
See, and to me, kind of what you're alluding to there is people are doing this work, whether they're doing it in more of the let's try the things and try them side by side in the field and look at them, or let's take the thing and look at it under a microscope. Because they're seeing, you put it, the emperor has no clothes. Well, to me, the image on the screen, for those that are on the audio, I'll describe. There's a gentleman standing behind a fence. Looks like farm country. It is. And there's a 2-meter measuring stick stuck in the ground beneath him. And his feet are about level with the top. And what it looks like is a cutout road. What that is the stick is in a field that's been growing food for 100 years. And the gentleman's standing on native prairie. So that area has lost 2 meters of topsoil in 100 years doing it the way, experts say it's supposed to be done. And I think people are just starting to look at that and say, hold on a minute. If you guys are so good at what you do, then why has the average farm field in this country lost 2 meters of topsoil over the last century? Why do we have dead zones the size of the state of Delaware in the Gulf of Mexico every year? Why are farmers still barely able to make a living using the most advanced technology we've ever had? Why are the chemical companies and the pesticide companies some of the richest companies in the world, along with the pharmaceutical companies and the food distribution companies, while the farmers are clinging by what's left of their fingernails? Maybe you're not right. And I think when a person reaches that point, people are smart. I should say, from the words of Tommy Lee Jones from Men in Black, right? A person is smart, right? People are stupid. But a person that has that revelation then says, well, what can I do? And I think they just find a thread to pull on. And that's either I'm going to go out and start a garden and see how things work. I'm going to get involved with someone like Matt and what he's doing. I'm going to, you know, become a follower of someone like Chris Trump, who's just all in on it. But they're going to find something, and then from there they'll figure out where their journey goes. But as soon as you start pulling that thread, the tapestry just starts to unwind so fast. And you don't necessarily know the answer, but you know when you're looking at something that ain't the answer. And I think I've had a lot of that. I've found things I'm like, oh, we just need this. When I've come to the conclusion of there is no just need this, right? What are you doing? Where are you doing it? And what do you want to happen? And I think part of the whole thing that screws up permaculture, even regenerative ag people and whatever, is you can't do it exactly like nature. Yeah, you can work with nature, but is it natural, even if you're doing an integrated crop on your 20 acres, for 10 of it to be in corn at any one time? Probably not. Or tomatoes or peppers. I'm not picking on corn here. I'm just saying, like, what we're doing, especially if we're not doing backyard, like, food forest integration, like, walk through and graze as a homeowner. If you're actually running a farm, it will never be exactly like nature. And so we have to do some things to adapt to that, because we're growing a tomato in Pennsylvania. They do great, but that's not where tomatoes come from. That's not the native. The tomato is a Southwest desert plant. That's what it is, right? That's why we overwater them and they split, because they're actually a desert plant. And so we have to adjust along with that, bring the natural elements in, but still understand if we don't do anything, you know what happens. Because haven't you seen people like, whoa, you don't have to do anything, and they throw a garden in, and then what comes next?
Weeds.
Weeds, pest, blight, cucumber mosaic virus or whatever, like something comes, and it wipes everything out.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, 90% of dairy has lost its – like 90% of the nutritional value of dairy has been lost since 1945. And so we really are looking at a situation where the actual value for the farmer, the actual value for the consumer, all of it has been hollowed out. And so people have a hunger. People have a deep desire, deep knowing that something is wrong. And that's why we feel called to grow food. And I know when I eat the food that I grow, like the melons I ate this year, they're by far the best melons I've ever eaten, like the best cantaloupe I've ever had. And it's because the soil is incredible, and I do foliar sprays. You know what I mean? We're in the South.
Yeah.
And when the humidity hits really strong and the heat hits at the same time, your evapotranspiration stops. And so you need to supplement your water with water-soluble calcium. That's the, you know.
Well, that was a huge one for me.
Yeah.
Your buddy, what's his name?
Fraser?
Pot guy. Yeah, Steven. I wanted to say Stefan, and it wouldn't go away. So Steven got me on to this thing with the calcium. I'm like, dude, I have calcium through the roof here. I'm sitting on limestone. My water has calcium. And he's like, but your plants can't get it. When it's 100 degrees, your plants cannot take it out of the soil. They're not capable of doing it. And I think that, you know, then you look at the woods behind the place and go, well, they look fine. Well, they don't need it the way your annual vegetable needs it, right? They can bank it, and your tomato can't bank it because it's still actively growing rapidly at that point. And what I've seen with the foliar of calcium, like, my peppers always did great. I never had problem. Like, I'm the pepper whisperer, people say. But what I would get is this massive amount of peppers. Super heat comes in. A plant looks great. Nothing happens to the plant. But it doesn't blossom. Yeah. Cold weather comes back in September, huge second flush of peppers. And I mean, my fall flushes are, they're stupid, like multiple shopping bags full of peppers from a dozen plants. But when I started doing a full year with calcium plus doing a full year with bioactive compost, all of a sudden I get blossoms right through the heat now, and I get peppers through the heat. You know, the only thing I have to worry about now is making sure there's enough counterbalancing shade plants so the peppers don't get sunscald. Because there's not, you know, 105 degrees and you're beating on the skin of a pepper, you're going to burn it. We burn PVC pipe down here, for God's sake. You know what it's like. You moved here. Because you're a sick man like me. You're a permaculture masochist just like me. You like hard environments.
Yeah, I definitely like the heat. It's funny. But you get such good seeds, you know.
Yeah.
Dry down to heat, you know. So yeah, it is the case that we do need to jump in sometimes, but setting up your soil, making it so that there's no antagonisms, making that you sure that you have a high enough soil organic matter, having that intermittent or companion crop, cover cropping, it becomes common sense, and it's so easy to do. I mean, you've got the seasonal, you know, trimmings from all your yards, you know, and you turn that into biochar, and then you can incorporate that, crush it up, incorporate that into the compost that you're making. And then you're layering that on as that top layer of mulch, letting that, you know, bond and become more soil and planting in that. It's so easy. It's very natural. Even if you're doing Johnson Sue, like Jack is, you're also on that annual cycle. Again, cyclical. Well, how would nature do this? Nature takes a year for a lot of things to be right. That's why microbes, you know, they're designed to survive in your soil for a year and a half to 2 years. Why? So you can have a bad year.
Yeah, and that way there's enough of a remnant to reestablish, right? That's like, think of it like when you watch a sci-fi movie and like, the city gets wiped out, but a few guys go down in the tunnel and they wait. And when the aliens leave, they come out and repopulate. Like, that's what your microbes are literally doing. They're going down in the tunnel. And one of the reasons I went all in on biochar about 2 years ago is I understood what it did for that alone, just for that one thing. Right. So I've seen people trial it and say there wasn't really a big difference. Well, one, you hadn't given it enough time yet. But what you just said is key. The fact that those microbes now have shelters, they have bomb shelters. Think of it that way. And they can go into those little pores in that biochar, and they can last in there way longer than anywhere else. And if a tiny droplet of water gets near that apartment, that biochar is going to suck that stuff in there like instantaneously, and it will hold that moisture longer than just about anything else in your soil, and it'll never go away. Now, never is a long time. One day the earth will go away when the sun burns it up. I'm talking in human life cycles. It's forever. It's thousands of years that's going to be in that soil.
Yeah, and it also depends on how good your compost is. You know what I mean? Some people's, you know, crappier compost is going to break down because it's like, you know, fully charred, right?
Yeah.
So there's a, you know, there's aspects to that. I think that the amazing finished true pyrolysis biochar that we get from, like, Michael, right, is very different. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And a lot of homemade stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. So holds three times its mass in water. And so again, it's like one of those things. You're like, wait, three times its mass in water. I'm adding like 5% biochar to my soil profile this year because I did a huge cutback, set up this new area, made a ton of biochar. 5%. So it's 15. I just added 15% more water holding capacity to my soil.
Yeah. Another way to think about it, instead of mass, because that's volume, is weight. So biochar holds seven times its weight in water. That means about a pound, 1.2 pounds of biochar will hold a gallon of water. You really have to think, like, so then start thinking, what if you add per bed over a few seasons, 100 pounds of biochar? That's 700 pounds of water. That is the difference between making it between two rain events and not easily. Plus it's the, again, you're back to what you're saying, like two ways I've described it. One, it's a bomb shelter, but two, it's more like a coral reef.
Yeah.
So like out in Florida where I go fishing by Sanibel Island, they took down the old causeway, They loaded all the concrete up on the causeway. They went 7 miles offshore, and they dumped it in a big line to make a reef. And the first year when divers went down there, like, there was a few fish hanging out because it's structure, but it's really not doing anything. Like, 10 years later, there's corals on it. There's colonies everywhere. But you gave it the framework because the place they dumped it, until they dumped that foundation, there was nothing. It was just open water, very little life, and now it's this thriving ecosystem. So the other way I see biochar in the soil is it's like that foundation of the coral reef. So all that life can grow in and on it and expand. And that's why I think if you look at a study on biochar and it hasn't progressed for at least 5 years, then it's inconclusive. And I would say that's a bare minimum. They did a study in Oregon, and this was raw char. It was also char. They did char, but they didn't do what you think. It wasn't a rigged one. They did it controlled. They did a raw char. They did a char plus fertilizer. They did just fertilizer. They did just mulch. So they also, because it was forestry work. It's straight up forestry, not ag. They go into the forest. They take a giant chipper shredder in there, and they chip up all the stuff and throw that down in one spot. They do the biochar by itself. They do the biochar plus fertilizer, and they do the fertilizer. First 4 years, the fertilizer and the mulch outperformed everything else. So just fertilizer, just mulch. The fertilizer and biochar was right there. The fifth year, the straight biochar by itself freaking 2X'd everything else in biomass production because it took half a decade for that raw char to really take over. But because it wasn't fertilized, because the fertilizer was a chemical fertilizer, like a 10-10-10, because it wasn't corrupted and it built its own things from the indigenous microorganisms in the forest, it eventually outperformed everything, even though it was like, if you put that in your garden, you're doing it wrong. If you put uninoculated char, so they did it the worst possible application, given enough time, produced the best result. Now, I'm not saying, and Matt's not saying to put raw char in your garden. I think we're both of the opinion that the best thing to do with it is put it in your compost and give it time with your compost. And when the compost goes in it, you don't even have to worry about it. But
because then you know you're keying it to the right pH that you prefer.
Yeah. The pH thing's interesting to me too. When you heard the pH of my compost, you're like, that doesn't even make any sense. And then when you came here, you're like, well, he's patient. I think I'm more lazy than patient. I have about 25 yards of wood chips sitting in my field, and some of them have been there for 3 or 4 years, and I'm taking the oldest first in making the compost, and I'm combining that with straw, with poultry manure, and aquatic plants and biochar, and I'm getting about a 6.8 pH in my compost out of my bioreactors, just under neutral by a hair. And you know, Texas soils, it's alkaline as shit. The last thing you need is more alkalinity here, and that's with biochar in it. That's probably got a pH of like 8.5. But it buffers down because of the process and the time. And I did something this year that I had never done before. I took two bioreactors that were half done, pulled them off, combined them into a single one because I needed the space. It wasn't optimal. But what an educational experience. I don't know if you've ever seen like a cow that got killed and you actually see the rumen.
Yeah.
What came out of that bioreactor looked like second stomach rumen.
Yeah.
And I almost think that, now, Dr. Johnson gets to call it whatever he wanted because he made it popular. But I think biodigester is actually a better term for what we're doing. It is digestion. It's just, it's bacterial and fungal digestion, which is, by the way, kind of what the cow's doing too. It just does it faster, right? Yeah. You know, optimal temperature and moisture. That's what you're doing there.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. All these things are a part of very similar cycles. The microbes that are key to decomposition and also endophytes inside plants are also key to our digestion. It's like, where did they come from in the first place? You know what I mean? The plants.
Yeah. So what would you tell people as far as composting? Like, what is your preferred method? Or do you have, like, multiple methods? Like, where would you tell people to start with making good compost?
Well, different composts do different things, and within one type of compost, you have a bunch of ranges, right? It's like, you know, within a certain group of people, you got tall people, short people, fat people, skinny people. You know what I mean? You guys have a lot of variation.
Yeah.
And so like vermicompost, for instance, people are like, oh, I do vermicompost. It's always in my kitchen scraps. It's like pH 7.58.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, that's hypertypical. And they're like, oh, it's so bacterial, always bacterial. And I'm like, okay. But I know people who are feeding their worms a steady diet of fungal substrate. And there are many with other things, but it's mostly like use fungal substrates. So in other words, it's a lot of fungi in their worm castings. They're highly fungal. And so that, and they're more acidic because fungi is acidic. And so this idea that it has to be one thing or the other, it just doesn't work that way. Instead, there's these ranges of expression, and there are things that go further in certain ranges. Like the Johnson Sioux is the most flexible, because it combines so many different methods, and because the ingredients are driving it, because it combines so many methods, it is that long scale, and it really is about the ingredients. So if you did, like, for instance, I have in my microscopy book, in this book, I've got the DNA on, and also the microscope case study on this pure leaf, just leaves, Johnson Sioux compost from Utah, and it's the highest fungal numbers I've ever seen. But when you think about it, leaves are the most stubborn things to break down. You're like, how are these leaves still here? The high lignin. What breaks them down? It's fungi.
Fungus.
Totally.
Fungus.
And so this is that compost right here that was published in that book. This is the same sample. Can you guys see the moisture, how it touches the side? It's still moist. In fact, there was a growing plant inside of it, and I kept it in a box for 2 years straight. And when we looked at it under the microscope this past week, it looked amazing. So you have to ask yourself, if in a two-cup sampling, if it creates a biome, when I don't fully close it, I leave it a little bit open.
Yeah, you gotta let it breathe, but you also got to, like, not let it get dry. Like, dry is
I bad. Don't – I have never added water to that compost.
Really?
Ever in 2 years.
Huh.
And you have to ask yourself, well, if something is added to a soil and then has benefit for over 8 years, wouldn't it still have those beneficial characteristics when isolated? Yeah, and it still does. This is the most fungal compost still that I've ever seen. It's so filled with spores. There's testate amoebae, big ones and small ones, in here right now. So we don't have nematodes in here. It was too long for nematodes. But this is incredible beneficial compost. Even now, 2 years, only two cups isolated and just held in stasis. And so good compost, the reason it has benefit for years is because those traits maintain themselves, because the foods remain. And so talking about biochar remaining and having lasting value, the wood lignin in leaves has this season to season to season for years long breakdown in the soil. And you're like, yeah, but every year there's more leaves. Exactly. So mm-hmm. there's all these iterations of different seasons and years and different, like, different layers, but also because there's disturbance too. But they're in different rates of decomposition. And, you know, a few years ago, someone, I felt so bad for like, I think Javin. Javin ran around being like, humus isn't real. Humus isn't real. And I'm like, oh, dear. yeah, he went crazy with that one. But
I'm telling you right now, half of water's not real.
Yeah, it's like, slow down. We have to remember that humic acids that are and folic acids that are created through an artificial process are artificially created. So they're literally real things, but they're artificially created. So those things aren't necessarily created in the soil. Totally. I get it. But humic compounds are totally real, and they're always in a rate of decomposition. And so they're always getting finer and finer and finer. And when I put this, it's right here. Last week into the test tube, it changes the color of the water like instantly. This has been settling for a week, yet it still has the yellowish, brownish, fulvic coloring to it. And that's because this natural breakdown is releasing humic acids and is releasing fulvic acids, but it's not at that rate. They're all tied in these humic compounds. And they're loosened a little bit when we add water, as you can see. But they're tied up in these large chain carbons. And the way they created the humic acids was they hit it with something so acidic it turned the soil into a gumball, you know. So I understand why they got confused. They didn't understand how they were doing it, why they were doing it, and what it actually meant. The reality is all these things that we add to the soil, we never finish, like, the composting process.
No.
Nature continues it in the soil as food and habitat for the microbes themselves. So when I look at them under the microscope, even this compost, I'll see pieces of insect, pieces of organic matter that are covered in biology, still working on it 2 years after he took a year to make it.
Yeah.
So this is 3 years after those leaves fell, and they're still breaking down. And that's what's happening every time you add to this it's just always happening. It's a constant, it's like a field of decomposition and change.
And I'm going to use a word here that I don't want anybody to take the wrong way, create. So I don't mean like spontaneous generation or abiogenesis, but it's constantly creating life. Now, the life has to come from somewhere, a spore, an egg, a colonizing insect, but it's still creating life. And the way I mean that is if that wasn't there as a base, that life would not be there with it. And I don't know if you've ever heard this term before, resurrection jar. It's something out of the aquarium space, but it's also a really good way to understand what you're talking about. So the way it's a great kids project, right? So get yourself like a big mason jar, like a half gallon one. Go to a place where it's like a creek with like a slow area in it, or like a back swell, or like a marsh. And don't intentionally catch anything alive. Go in and take the muck out of the body of water and fill the bottom of that jar at about 1.5 to 2 inches deep. Take some leaves and debris around the edge, and then fill the jar with water. Leave a little space in the top. Loosely put the top on so there's some air exchange, and set it in a sunny window and wait 2 weeks. And the jar, without a microscope, will crawl with life. And what will be in there? I don't know, right? Every place you do it and every time of year that you do it, you're going to get a different result. But I've seen things like the Medusa hyphae looking things. I can't think of what they're called right now. I've seen water fleas and diatoms and like just like all little red worms and shit in there. And then every once in a while, you'll end up with like, you didn't know, but when you scooped it up, you ended up with a couple tiny fry mosquito fish. And as soon as all those worms start growing on, the mosquito fish gets big enough, they eat the shit out of those. Like, you have this entire ecosystem in a jar that was literally mud, leaves, and water.
Yeah.
And when you look at that, you say to yourself, well, what we really build when we build soil, and this was an epiphany I had a long time ago, is we're building a lake. It's just a dry-ish lake. So I think it was one of Mollison's lectures I listened to 15 years ago, and he talked about that in a foot of soil in a healthy forest, you have 1 inch of water.
Mm. So
if you have a 3,000-acre forest, and you have 3 foot of soil, which is not at all a challenge in an older forest like that, and you start folding it onto itself, you basically have a 200-acre lake that's 10 feet deep.
Yeah.
And if you start seeing it that way, then you understand we're actually building aquatic ecosystems in the soil. I know that sounds crazy, but when you put it under a microscope, does it look much different than pond water?
If you don't do bright field, which is the traditional one where the light's shining through and blasting you in the eye.
Yeah.
Don't do eyepieces, please. I want to save your eyes. Use a camera instead and use a screen, much more civilized. But bright field is only one way to do it, and it blasts these tender little organisms with light from below that they've never exposed to. Dark field is indirect light, and it's very gentle, and actually you see the true colors of things, and it all looks like the deep sea, deep ocean, or deep space. It looks like those two places.
Yeah.
And there's diatoms in my soil here there's rotifers in my soil here because it's a creek bed. It's creek bed sand. So we regularly get, you know, high water table flooding. Some of my trees are suffering from that right now. And so I see all those aquatic microbes. In fact, you know, you talk to someone about ciliates who's an expert in ciliates or expert in like amoeba, they're going to be focused mostly on water and aquatic environments, not soil. We're like an extrapolation of that whole space. We're like a small fraction of the giant space that of species they study. It's really wild when you get into it. I mean, we're really lucky in soil science that we have such a limited amount of. I know everyone's like, we only know 90% of the bacteria and da 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 da. I mean, we don't. We've got their identities. We know who they are, but we don't know what they're doing, what their function is really right now. And it's so small compared to the ocean in terms of the amount of biology that we're dealing with. Because the soil, like you said, 1 inch for like 12 inches or 3 feet or something like that.
Yeah.
It's diffuse. And so it's a challenging environment that goes dry to wet constantly. And so you have a smaller group of microbes, and there's amazing, miraculous things. I mean, like testate amoebae, I keep saying testate, that means shell. That's all it means. A test is a shell. So they're shelled amoebae, and those are the safe ones. The ones that are naked are the ones that eat your brain and go up your nose when you go swimming in like the local
or something. Yeah.
Those ones are way common in stagnant water. And they're much less common in healthy soils, actually. It's the testate because they need that shell to handle the dry and the wet. And they're the ones that are safe. And there's no, for the majority of them, and the ones that are in the soil, they're not going to be giving us problems. And so we've got all these incredible things baked into the soil there to buffer, there to protect. And once you learn what they are, you're like, oh, wow. Nature really wants to build soil. We just have to stop doing certain things.
Preventing it.
Right. Those cornfields I was talking about before, those farmers could easily be doing things regeneratively. They could easily be crimping that corn down. They could easily be interseeding, you know what I mean? They could easily be doing interseeding with their cover crop immediately. If they do top 6 inch till, if you immediately plant in what you just tilled and have a cover crop immediately start there, you can actually make it so that you don't lose the mycorrhizal fungi and you don't lose them. They occupy the same exact root zone rhizospheric microbes. And so Christine Jones was recently talking about this. And so what they typically have been doing for decades is they'll terminate the crop, they'll harvest it, and then they'll basically chemically terminate it and desiccate it and then leave it dead for months.
Yeah.
And so there's no carryover of microbes to the next generation. There's no protection of the soil. When they literally could just plant a cover crop right there, right then, and then at the end of that season, roll it over so it becomes a protective blanket on those microbes and keeps them for the next season. So we can fix the problems that we're facing so easily. It doesn't require, you know, a giant massive budget. It doesn't require giving, you know, subsidies to business, like gigantic, like businesses that don't need it. It really requires, you know, to like allow us to like do the right thing. And also to remove the incentives for the wrong thing, because the incentives are in place to do the wrong thing.
See, and I think we need that life because life begets life. And what I've said, and people get on me for it, is all healthy ecosystems have animal life. And they'll say, well, here's this organic system run by a vegan, and they don't do livestock, and look how healthy it is. And this is from my coming course, this slide right here. And you don't have animals, and it's for those on the audio, it's worms from one of my worm farms. It's a pill bug in my garden. It's a dung beetle. I had to steal that one because I haven't found any dung beetles here because I don't have the kind of livestock that would do that. It's a toad. It's a millipede. It's a smooth earth snake. It's a springtail, and it's a green tree frog. And yeah. Everything in that collage there except the dung beetle is from my property. And I have these things called ducks and geese and chickens that run around and eat those things. And they're still here in epic numbers. And I should have thrown a picture in there of a Cope's gray tree frog, because every time I put like a strawberry basket up or something, it's colonized by like 100 Cope's gray tree frogs. So there's animals in every healthy system. Now, if you desiccate, let's say, wheat, and you leave the straw behind after you take the wheat heads, when you go to plant in spring, you're going to end up, if you're doing conventional ag, you're going to plow, because the residue that you're talking about is still going to be there, and it won't break down because it's pure lignin, and it ain't fungi, and you've killed all the fungi, and then none of these critters are living in there. There's no activity in your soil, and you go, gee, why do I have to use more chemicals this year than last year? And I'm not saying the solution is easy, and I think you'd agree with that, because there's a learning curve to it, and it takes a lot of effort to move a still heavy object, which is what agriculture is. It's like a giant boulder sitting in a field, and you got to push it uphill, and it's not moving at all, right? But it is simple. Easy is the path of least resistance. Easy is government gives you a subsidy, you take it, you give it to the chemical guy, and you put it on your field. Right? That's easy. Simple is what we teach, which is nature has the answers. It's up to us to find them. The definition of simple is something you can do. And I don't think there's anything that either of us teach that people can't do, that somebody would run into an intellectual impediment incapable of doing what we're recommending. Like, it's assuming that, you know, you're not being cared for 24 hours a day. I think anybody could do this. It's just, will you?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's also why I collect all the different perspectives and recipes. I mean, in my book, I've got, you know, Jairo Restrepo's work, right? He takes excess, traditional chemicals that are leftovers on farmers' like sheds and stuff, and he's like, well, let's use biology to digest those, so A, they're not just sitting there like causing a problem, and B, you can actually train them to eat those things and then release that biology into your field, because those things are salting your field. They're the thing, he calls it trophobiosis. And it's a way of removing the toxins and over-fertilization in your soil, because the salts in the soils, they just bond to the organic matter. Think about this. If someone, because all the farmers, they all use salts that dissolve in water. It's amazing. Yeah, it dissolves in water. What happens when it dries back out? Oh, yeah, it turns back into a salt. So it binds with other things in the soil and salts the earth. And so you've got this overproduction of, like, phosphorus application of phosphorus in the soil. And it's there. It's these crystals that are holding in place, and they don't want to leave. And so that inhibits mycorrhizal fungi, it inhibits all these other reactions. But if you can digest those things with biology, if you can remove those things. And so I, like you said, people are in different areas. People also have different resources. So I've got hot compost, Johnson soup, vermicompost, IMO. I've even got the actual recipes for how to brew specific like bacteria and specific fungi. Whether it's trichoderma or mycorrhizal fungi, whether it's rhizobia or azotobacter or azospirillium, there literally is a recipe for it. And we can be brewing these things. We don't need to buy everything. You may need to buy the seed, but even if you can't get the seed, I mean, you just alluded to it. People all over the world are like, I want photosynthetic bacteria. I want purple non-sulfur bacteria. There's a recipe that you can literally get these things, and that pond water, when you let it settle out, it actually develops zones.
And oh, absolutely.
Each depth zone has a different consortium of bacteria.
Correct.
And one of those depths is the reddish. It's in between, you know, like true purple and red, and so it's always reddish. People, purple non-silver bacteria, they just say it's purple because there's something else that's also darker purple. But it's reddish, and that is the thing that everyone's adding to EM, that everyone's using as a biofertilizer. It's going crazy right now. And I'm going to add that recipe in there.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, I'll send you it as well. And so we have all these, if we are connected to nature, if we have that living pond, if we have that forest to go walk through and see these things played out so we can verify they're true. Because that's the thing, is nature is going to teach us how it works if we just let it. If we just do make a compost, it doesn't matter what kind of compost it is. Make the compost and observe it. Try to follow, you know, the rules and the guidance of whoever taught you, you know, as best you can. But you're going to learn from that process, and you're going to be like, wow, this person, they must be in a different climate because their days for how long this breaks down are totally wrong. Yeah. That's the first thing you'll learn.
Yeah.
You know, but you need to get into it. You need to start, because composting, once you understand how it works, is not hard. It's work, but it's so vital. It's so important to have this as a modality, because we're taking part in that constantly breaking down. We're taking part in that constant release. We're taking part in that cycle. And it's a world that never stops. And we are breaking this terrible pattern that traditional ag has made, where we have our season, and then the season ends.
Yeah, and then Nature doesn't end because the season shifted. Because the season doesn't end; it shifts. Right. The whole thing's a perpetual shift. Let me back up real quick to where you're talking about a cover crop, because when you talk about ag and you talk about rolling a cover crop, people think like, well, that's something that like a farmer with a giant machine can do. So this is from my coming cover crop course. And this is a combination, this method of termination here, and this slide's for flaming. But what happened is I flamed this cover crop, which means I just took a weed torch. And for big ag, they literally have like flamers that go behind like 18-foot swaths and do this. And you're not burning it. This is very important if you're going to flame a cover crop. You're not going to burn it. When you take spinach and throw it in a frying pan and it turns bright green and you're done, that's as quick. That's what you're doing. You're wilting it. You're causing the cells in the plant, the heat ruptures those cells. And then after it was flamed, it was crimped with a 2x4 with a piece of angle iron on it, and I stepped on it. When I say it's simple but not easy, that's what I mean. The easy thing to do would be take a rototiller, till the damn thing, and be done with it, right? But that's not the right thing to do. But you can do these techniques that like large scale ag is coming over to in your backyard. It's not hard to do. And I would ask somebody, let me pull that up again real quick, what would you rather plant into, bare dirt? Or would you want to plant into that? Like, I want to plant into that forever. I don't ever want to see bare dirt unless I'm doing, there's certain crops that kind of to plant them and all, you kind of have to get there, I guess. You know, carrot. Yeah, carrot is what I'm thinking of when I say that. Very fine seed. It needs light, whatever. But, I mean, everything I really grow comes straight up out of there. And I think the other thing people need to understand is, like, you mentioned zones in the jar. Well, there's zones in soil. And all that refuse on the surface, if you don't have all those little critters and you don't have that fungus that I showed earlier, that's going to sit there and dry up. And then it's going to off-gas, and it will do literally nothing for your soil other than act as a mulch. Like it'll suppress weed, it'll keep it cooler, but you have to have bioactivity in there to incorporate at least some of it, and most of it even then you're going to lose. It's the freaking roots below the soil line that really feeds the biology. When that plant's in its growth stage, it's literally pumping carbon into the soil, and I learned this from you. Eating the microbes. The plants are eating like that. I played it up a little bit at the workshop you were at when you dropped that, when I walked away and I'm like, right. But like I had listened to Elaine Ingham for so long and I love her, but it's all this, like now I call it a wonderful fiction. The plant, you know, it poops out a little exudate and this microbe that put its entire life into acquiring this resource willingly gives it up for a little drop of sugar. No, No, that's not. Nature is competitive and cooperative both, but it's more competitive, right? When people say we invented war, then you haven't seen a lion pride. Microbes in a microscope, right? Humans did not invent warfare. Warfare existed before we walked the earth over like resources.
Farming aphids,
and that's
right?
Like, oh, gee, like literally exploding and vacuuming microbes up. You're the first person I ever heard say that. Now I'm starting to hear it everywhere.
Heck yeah.
I'm starting to hear that everywhere. Like the plants are eating the microbes.
Yeah.
Like the and even the fungal. Like we shouldn't call it inoculating the plant with fungus. We're infecting the plant intentionally with fungus. It's just a symbiotic infection, but the fungus is infecting the plant and the plant is eating the bacteria.
Yeah.
Plants aren't vegan. Oh, that's going on the screen. carnivorous.
Yeah, and they're to an extent farming or ranching.
Yes.
They're breeding certain microbes and then releasing them again, and they don't go far. They're going to stay at that root hair tip and feed off of the exudates that come out of it. So they're in essence domesticated.
Hmm. They're training the microbes to come to them, and then they're eating them.
Right.
Like here, chick, chick. Right? Getting great.
Yeah, they're essentially ranchers and farmers themselves. And so what we're doing, you know, by raising animals for food is exactly what they're doing, raising animals for shearing their wool. That's very similar to what they're doing with the endophytes.
Yeah.
Using, you know, animal to help accomplish, you know, you're plowing your field or back in the day with a horse. That's exactly what microbes are doing inside plants when they're endophytes. We have these partnerships. We've got these relationships. Also, it's so funny. People are like, oh, we don't want to harm animals. I'm like, you know, the microscopic animals are animals too. You know, and then they're like telling like a buzzsaw. You know what I mean? And then, you know, plants can see you and react to you. So they're as, you know, as sentient as some of these animals, arguably, for some scientists right now. So those arguments don't really work. It really comes down to this fact that like everything is a sacrifice and should be like really honored and respected. We're so fortunate to have this life. We're so fortunate to have our freedom to be able to grow food, to be able to learn from nature, to be able to have this life and participate. I mean, this life is just so incredible that I think that we need to do more to like showcase how nature works, to learn from it and to feel that awe and respect. And leading from that space, I think will help a lot of people correct themselves. Because so many people out there thought they were doing the right thing. Oh dear. You know?
And
you know,
I don't blame them. They listen to the experts, right? And some of those experts are not the USDA-approved pharmacologist. Like, they listen to experts who really were doing their best with the information they had at the time. I mean, I fact-check everything that comes out of the media.
Yeah.
I barely ever even thought of fact-checking somebody like Elaine, right? I mean, why would I? The woman has more knowledge than I do in so many things, but then everything we ever thought we knew at one point reached a point where we realized it was actually something else. To me, that's one of the problems in academic science. The idea of advancement requires the death of what we perceive to be true. And almost it almost always works this way. As long as the person who put it in a textbook is alive, we can't go to the next. We have to wait for that generation to die. And I think the one thing that like the internet's really doing, because of things like we're doing right now and sharing this information, we're accelerating that. Like, you don't have to die before we get this out anymore. Like, we're just going to tell people, and you can't shut us up anymore. And when somebody says it doesn't work, and we go, well, look. Right. That's the beauty of the internet. Like, no matter what you say, Matt can pull up a slide of his microscope and say, there it is right there. That's a plant root exploding a bacteria. There it is. Right. Yeah. Or I can go out to my garden and say, We're sitting here in August. It's 109 degrees, and there's my tomatoes full of tomatoes, right? There's no way to get past that. And I feel like in some ways we're breaking a system more rapidly because the whole advancement of science is breaking the past to see the future. And if you learn nothing from COVID, like, that's not acceptable to the academics. We cannot have that. And as I've started doing research on not just this stuff, but other things like the state of North America prior to settlement, during settlement, and, you know, post-settlement, and the way people live, I'm starting to see, like, this is the case everywhere. Like, when they first started finding earlier remains, like in the 30s and 40s, like, citizen archaeology became a thing. And people are going, but this Clovis point is where in the soil you say it's not supposed to be there yet, and it's here, and it's right here. And they send all these academics in and basically make some bullshit up. And they would get, like, even back then, you just didn't see it because of not the internet, violent suppression. And I don't mean like they went and beat somebody with a bat. I mean, they would literally have these conversations, the academics on the back end. We can't have these amateurs out messing everything up and talking to people. They might believe them. We need to silence them ruthlessly. And I think we're reaching a point where you, good luck, go ahead, try it. Like,
yeah, I mean, Boneyard, Alaska is the great example, right? They dumped, I think it's like, it's priceless, but it's like billions of dollars of evidence that we had, you know, dire wolves. We had animals that weren't supposed to be up in Alaska during the last ice age were there somehow. And so the narratives, when they break, it's so vital. And we're always standing on the shoulders of giants. Elaine did such incredible work. I mean, yeah. One of the papers I cite is 3 weeks from before I was born, you know what I mean? By
yeah.
her.
Yeah.
And so it's like, she
yeah,
did
just real quick before you go on, please no one take anything that I or Matt say today to be anti-Elaine. Like, we couldn't get where we are without the work she did. Just to clear
that. Yeah. 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 And so we're always building up on, you know, standing on the shoulders of giants. But it is so critical that we do testing, that we do replication, because people are human. People are, a lot of academics just pass on what they hear and don't replicate it. And so I did the DNA testing on all these forms of compost, and then discovered that the anaerobic EM that was badmouthed by so many people was actually in all the good compost. Funny thing. And the reality is those microbes that are anaerobic are actually plant endophytes, and they're inside all plants. So that's why they're in the compost. So it's so incredibly important to do that replication work, to ask those fundamental questions, because right now in science, and people who come from science easily fall into these pitfalls because they trust their other scientists, you know, instead of being in this like, oh, well, did that actually work in the field? Oh, is that working in my garden? How does it look in nature? Let me go out to the forest and actually look. Those kinds of things have changed everything that we know in science right now. I mean, just health. I mean, people now can go back to the original, you know, papers on viruses, and they're like, this clearly isn't a real study. A person from our day and age can go back and read these early medical papers, read these early medical, early virus and plant virus papers, and recognize, like, this is fake. Like, they took the sick plants, combined them with salt, then sprayed the concentrated salts on the other plants, and the other plants got burned, and so they got the sickness. It's not a virus. Like they physically damaged the plant, right? And so, and I think they actually like sandpapered it in or something weird. Like they, if you read some of our early, and it goes for almost every form of science, the fundamentals that we base things off of, like the tetanus shot, all these kinds of things, you dig into them and you're like, there's no way a modern day person would read that and accept that as truth. No way. But we built up so much momentum that people are just running on this thin ice or running on thin air, thinking that they can continue. And it's unacceptable. It's just unacceptable because it's our health. It's our kids' futures. It's our food. And it's our freedom. So much of this stuff, it's like they're trying to close the door on the basics, like your the control of everything. Everything. I mean, from the way they're handling cars with kill switches to the way in the 70s that they like started moving away from carburetors, mm-hmm. like all of it is a way. That, I mean, you go to talk to someone from the EU for me. Just do that. Just do that. Ask them how seed saving works over there. And they'll be like, do you have heirloom seeds? How did you get heirloom seeds? Can you send me some
like you have crack cocaine or something, right? Like, hey, do you know where I might be able to get some? Right? Like, well, I mean, it literally is like that, right?
But that's how the government treats it. They treat it like it's an illicit drug. Meanwhile, these are things that grandmothers are saving and swapping at a nice little gathering at the local civic center. And they're talking about like, oh, my tomatoes, these are the best ones, crack resistant. You know, like
old,
normal, human, fundamental freedom.
And this is my message to anybody listening to this today, whether they're out of my audience or yours. The only way you get that is if you let them. You can't stop drugs from being imported from China through Mexico, but they're going to stop you from saving a pepper seed. Your compliance is required for their agenda to succeed. Like it amazes me that people talk about, well, what the government will let us do. Like, let us do? I didn't ask your permission, bitch, to save the seeds out of my tomato, and I'm not gonna. Like, this can only work if we let it work, and I refuse. I'm like, if I have to die on the hill of saving tomato seeds, go ahead. Like, I guess I'll be a martyr for tomatoes. I don't know. Like, there are certain things that if government goes too far with and people actually resist it, they look so stupid they can't do it.
Yeah.
And I think going after somebody for saving the seeds out of their garden, that would – but what happened in the EU, sad to say, like the spirit of revolution is Europe originally, and they have become the most compliant herd-like people on the planet. They have bought all in on socialism, and I know individuals – like, again, I'm back to a person is smart, people are stupid, you know, right? No, really, like – a person is smart, and people are a collective mass of hysterical nuts. And so if you're from Europe and you're hearing this, I'm not picking on you. I'm saying look out your windows and see what the average person that lives next to you is like when the government says you have to do a thing. Like, I don't know about you, but when my government told me I had to wear a mask, I told them to take their mask and stick it in their ass. Like, I just didn't do the things I was told to do. And it was amazing, like one person not doing it created other people not doing it, right? And that's why they violently attack anything that stands up, like a nail that has to be driven back down because, well, you didn't do what we said. And it's not that you didn't do it. It's that other people might start not doing it. So I'll save my seeds till the end of my life. You're not getting my seeds, right? I will make compost. I will raise my birds. You can cry all you want about bird flu, and you can stick that right up your hairy butt. I am not giving up one. Well, I'm not giving one inch at this point. They have taken so much that the line has been drawn. We're done. You don't get any more. What does it say in the Bible? To hither thou shalt come and no further. I've reached that point in my life.
It's really wild. I'm always like wanting to like tweet, like, get ready, save seeds, save food, have fuel, have, you know, generator, you know, back up everything, because I think that when we actually realize where this is headed, there's going to be a boycotting, essentially. People are going to stop, and then there's going to be a reaction. And so, yeah, we need to have those seeds in place. We need to have our gardens in place. We need to have food storage. I grow a lot of squash, a lot of winter squash, because they're keepers. I keep that. And squash is different. It's like I can eat squash raw. Like you can eat squash raw.
Yep.
You know what I mean? It's not great. You know what I mean? I love it when it's in pumpkin pie. But it's a survival crop. And so I always focus on making sure I have survival foods. And also the other thing is the seeds from your squash, you can sprout and eat them too.
Correct.
So it's a very useful, survival crop. And this year, I've been focused so much on soil that I've never had this level of, like, prolific, abundance. I've had more melons I've ever had, the largest melons that I've ever had, the just gorgeous squash. I mean, they're all around 20 pounds each.
Yeah.
And they're, like, this tall, this wide. They're boxy. They're Queensland blue, primary, the genetics Queensland blue, but they're open pollinated for years with me, so I know there's probably something else in there.
Yeah.
But they're chunky. I mean, most Queensland blue are, like, tight and small, and they look like a little, they look like a button almost, like an inverted button. But these ones have, like, 8 to 6 inches thickness to them. So just gorgeous. And I know that's because I'm supplying – this is the second year I've grown in these soils. It was pure sand, like pure sand and silt before. There was no organic matter. I tested it when I arrived. It was 0.6 organic matter. Okay. I've doubled.
That's pretty
doubled.
All right.
Yeah, I've doubled it in the season, so it's 1.2 now. Exactly.
For those on the video, for those on the audio, I have a Queensland blue squash up right now. But that's what Matt's – that's a typical way that they look.
Yeah, exactly. So mine are, like, look like swollen. I have a picture on social media of me with it right now where I'm holding, like, five of them. It's actually four of them, so it's like 80 pounds I'm holding. And it's a food that just like so many of the things we talk about, it's really important to just have those backups. It's important to be, I mean, if they go rotten, they're incredible for accelerants for composting. Like, I have a few that are rotten. I'm putting them in the center of my compost and they're going to just go crazy. And also, I'm going to remove the seeds first, save the seeds, because they were first fruit. That's part of the reason why during this past rain, and I had oral surgery, so I couldn't, like, go in the sun before this rain. It's all cool off right now, but right before this, pounding heat. And so, like, I would sleep in because I'm supposed to get enough rest, and then I'd, like, come out into the sun, and I'd be like, cannot do it. So my first fruits got rotten, so I'm going to save their seed and then put the rest of the squash in the compost.
I end up doing a lot of that too, either that or feeding it to the birds, because I do what you do. I grow it and I save it because I have it. And when I get back into the production season, most of it I actually don't eat, right? It's more of, like you said, a survival crop. Now, you mentioned the way it grows. I saw something a few years ago that I literally drove an hour to my brother-in-law's to see it because I didn't believe him. He took the pumpkin that they had for Halloween for the kids. And he threw in his compost pile. He's not like me. This is not a guy that's he's just throwing all his kitchen waste in, like, a static compost pile. And he said that the pumpkin grew from the stem of the top of the jack-o'-lantern. And I said, Mark, that's not a thing. That does not happen. And I drove down there and, bro, it was exactly what he said. It literally, the pumpkin top started regrowing and had a 20-foot vine along his fence that he had, like, used sticks to keep it out of the way of the lawnmower. Now, I've never seen anything like that in my life. I don't know if maybe there was a seed embedded up in there or something, but when I pulled back, it was the top of the pumpkin growing out. Have you ever seen anything like that in your life?
No, but I think of, when they talk about tissue sampling, they can take just a little section of tissue and regrow plants, right? And where we live, so warm here that it's like living inside an ideal lab for growing things.
Mm.
So depending on the time of year, August's a little bit too hot. But
yeah, but you know, that probably started growing like coming into the spring that year, right? And like, I literally didn't believe him. But now that you say that, like, tissue culture is a thing. And it may just be that everything was just right in that compost pile. Because he's literally just anything left over, just throwing it in there. Like, he doesn't turn it. He doesn't cover it. He doesn't maintain it. He just throws it in there in the corner of the yard where it's shaded. That's like the one thing he did that made sense, is he put it where it's almost always shaded. And, man, it was crazy that that happened. And that just tells you what biology is capable of doing. That things that you don't think are possible. The other thing that I've noticed is, and you mentioned with your squash, the more I do of this, the more the form of the plant and the fruit change.
Mm-hmm.
Like when I started, I had really good results with peppers, like I said, but my plants were 6 foot tall, right? And very productive. And they would get so productive that it would rain. And like, I'd go out and pick a limb of like 50 jalapenos up off the ground. Because when the plant took the water in and gave it to the peppers, the weight broke the limb off the and I'm not complaining, but that's the form of the plant. Now my peppers are 2.5 foot tall, and they're like freaking honey badger. They're like literally a dip, and they're the same seeds. I've been saving these seeds for 20 years. It's the same seeds, and the form of the plant changes, like you were saying, with the form of your squash. Well, that's not genetics. It's epigenetics. It has to be.
Yeah. And that's what I'm saying. I say, like, it's a Queensland blue variety, but you look at it, and then when I first started with the Queensland blue, it looked like the spaceship from Flight of the Navigator. You know what I mean? It's had a more elliptical squat. Yeah. And just like yours are starting to get taller and taller, like, mine have become, like, I mean, you can see in the picture. I probably pull it up. But
you should be able to share if you want to on the screen.
Okay. Let me just grab it.
I'm not sure. Is it online, though? It might be a little.
Yeah, I can just. How do I get it? How do I do it?
It depends. you want to text it to me on the back end and just talk, and I'll do it for you?
I'll just do that.
All right.
Yeah. So it's amazing because that's essentially like nature tailoring it to you. Nature's tailoring that to your backyard and your care and situation and your management. And all of us could be, I mean, this is why you would have a particular squash or pepper or tomato named after a bioregion. Oh, they'd be like, that's the Ozark peach.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what I mean? And it grows best there. And they develop special recipes around it, and it becomes part of the culture. That's really what's missing from our culture is this sense of place. Sense of place has a lot to do with what you grow there and what you eat that is grown there. You get it. You literally embody that because our food becomes us. It's that.
Okay, cool. I'll get it up for you in just a second.
They look like they're from some, like, dinosaur, like, prehistoric kind of thing. And the skin on them is so shiny. And this comes from good soil. And we're in a climate where there's fungal spores in every breath. There's mold spores in every breath because it's so humid. Things break down so fast here. You need to have plants that are naturally able to fight. And they do that when they get the right soil. They do that when, you know, you have that water-soluble calcium ready. Or the compost tea, because there's water-soluble calcium in there as well. Because calcium is a major component in cell walls. So because it's a macronutrient, it is in all your compost too.
And I've got the image up. Again, those of you guys on the audio, you'll have to look up the video if you want to see it. But you're right. Those are very large for that variety. But they're also formed differently. I see what you mean. They're very box-like instead of more flat and rounded. And that's biology. That's not – you didn't infuse them with some sort of other DNA or something like that. That is a response to the local situation. And I've heard John Kempf talking about this a lot lately, that like when you get proper nutrition into the plant literally looks different. It's not just that it's bigger, it's brighter, it produces more. It literally changes form. And that actually makes perfect sense. If I take a human being and I feed them from the time they're a baby a malnourished diet, and I take a twin of that baby and I feed them an optimal diet based on fat and protein, which would be an optimal diet for a human, when those two kids are 20 years old and young men, they're going to look drastically different. Their physical form will be different, even if I feed them the same amount of calories.
Yeah.
Right? If I just feed them a different nutritive diet, but the same, like they both get 2,200 calories a day, they're going to be very different looking beings. They might not even look like twins at that point, even though they are.
Yeah. Yeah, and then the workout, right? If they work out, and that's kind of what happens when we save seeds. You're selecting from the ones that do the best in the worst soils quite often. And you're like, this is the one that can perform regardless. And then suddenly you get those, you feed them the ideal, you know, the ideal foods at the same time, and you get these just like, they're the Michael Jordans.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
They're so clearly better, like physically than performance wise than everyone else. And then you can select and then you can save that. And so,
And
it's in that conversation. I mean, a huge part of it is that genetic potential that is being unlocked. When you hit the full genetic potential, the plant is putting on so much more fruit that they actually have to be structurally different. That's why your plants are stockier and stronger so that they could hold more and not have those breakages. That year, that plant was like, oh, my arm just fell off.
Yeah.
Keep all the seeds to remember this.
Yeah.
And next year, they were like, well, we're not doing that again. Remember our arms fell off? That was terrible.
Now I've lost where I was going to go next because that was
my arms are falling off.
Distracting my arms are falling, right?
But it's been a great year. I'm really happy with like just the amount of change that I've seen. I actually had I had to experience kind of a hard knock last year because I was away on a trip. I was going off of the well. The well went dry. My family didn't notice. And I came back and everything was like destroyed. And I was like, what's going on? And the well was dry. And then when I was going to switch to city water and filter it, they banned all watering. And so I'm putting in a totally different system that is the one exemption right now. It's a commercial drip system, not automated drip system. And so I'll be able to be exempt if they ever do that again. I don't think they're going to do that this summer because we're getting so much rain. But they still may. They still may.
You are. Yeah, I'm 200 miles north, and the rain we just got, like the little outcast bit of rain from the hurricane, was the first rain we've had since April.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So like, well, it's just normal here. Like, we got a good spring, I'll give you that. With my terrain, though, for those on your side that don't know my history, I've got between 11 and 4 inches of soil on my property. And when I say that, I don't mean subsoil. I mean limestone rock shoal, right? Like, so I don't have much battery. So I have to be really conscious of everything I do. And that's why, like, all my annuals are in 2-foot deep raised beds. Because that's the only way to develop any kind of battery as far as soil battery underneath them. Because it's not about biology or chemistry at that point. It's about volume. Right. You're not going to hold that much water in 2 inches of soil sitting on rock. Like, it's almost as bad as growing like in a church parking lot. But yet people have done it, and you do it by building the ecosystem up. That's, you know, and people say, well, like, just break the rock up. No, you don't understand. The rock goes 160 feet and it's still there. Right. So if you go down into the rock, you've created a basin that water can't get out of. You've created a pond in the rock, right? So like the water will weep the first 11 inches in the fractured rock. And when you get down 11 inches here, if you keep going, it looks like a sarcophagus. It is complete white concrete, basically nature's concrete. And the top stuff, you've seen it. It looks at a distance, you go, that looks like concrete rubble. And up close, it's all seashells. Yeah. Right? Because the Great Inland Sea went right over your house and right over my house where we are right now 50 million years ago. And we just happen to be closer to the outcropping of it here than you are. Like, you got to go down 100 feet where you are to find it. I got to go down 4 inches.
And it depends on where you are. It's closer to the surface. If you go over to the hill country where it's got these ridges,
you can see
those sections.
Yeah, you can just
down
see
here
it
in the valley. It's just sand. Yeah, we're just sand and some clay.
I'm so stupid, man. Like 20 years ago, when I was in outside construction, I had crews down south of here, 25 miles in Granbury, and we were pulling up whole Nautiluses.
Whoa.
And just pitching them to the side. Like, we were working 14 hours. It's 110 degrees out. Like, oh, that's cool. Throw it over there. I'll get it later. And I think I took one home to my son. And, like, these were, like, I mean, you know, big, like, twice the size of your head.
Dang.
Perfectly preserved. And that's just, that's what people look at this and you don't realize, like, stuff changes. Like, our time as humans on this planet is, you know, 1 second to midnight if you measure Earth in a 24-hour day. We are a few seconds from midnight in showing up today. Like, and that's another thing I think that we need to think of with ag and permaculture and regen ag and all this stuff is these processes predate us, right? We're not as smart as we think we are. Somehow all of this worked before we even got here. And I don't know if you've ever had to like take over a company or take over a crew or something. If you're a good leader, the first thing you do before you start running your mouth and telling how everybody's going to be now is to figure out how they got, even if there's problems, how did you get where you are? What have you been doing? How have you been trained? How has this all worked up till now? So at least when you make a change, you know what you're jacking around with. As a species, when it comes to natural systems, we're just like, I don't like that. I'll move it. I don't like that. I'll blow it up. I'll dig a hole. I'll collapse it. Let's put a lake over here. Well, you know, or Lake Okeechobee in Florida is a perfect example. So a lot of people don't know this. Lake Okeechobee is a massive lake, but most of it you can walk in. It's very shallow. It's a giant puddle in the middle of the Everglades. And the way the water gets out of the lake into the two rivers, it's the Swallowhoosie and something else that go to the Atlantic and the Gulf, is it drains through the Everglades for miles slowly. And the rivers, before we touched it, you couldn't get to the lake on the river. You would eventually get to the point where it just became a tangled mass and you were about 10 miles from the lake. Corps of Engineers doesn't like that. So what do? They go in there and they cut a channel. And the last 10 miles, if you take a boat up either lake now, is a concrete canal that goes all the way to the lake. So what does the lake do now? Straight out. So we get heavy rains in the summer. All of that nutrient blows out of there. Then you take all the houses they've built along this stuff with the True Green Chem Lawn, and all the sugar cane farms with all their chemical, that goes into those two rivers, and we get massive red tides. And the last time that it happened, I was walking the beach, and there were dozens, Matt, of groupers bigger than me, dozens of tarpon bigger than me, laying dead on the beach. And I fished there my whole life, and they have very strict regulations. Like, you can't even take a Goliath grouper out of the water. You take its picture, you unhook it, and you let them go. And there's thousands of these fish laying dead. The livelihood of all these fishing guides is laying dead on the beach because we looked at something without knowing what it did and changed it before we understood it. And to me, that's the analogy for everything we've done. But that's why that picture I showed earlier, where the dude's standing 6 feet higher than what's left, we touched things without knowing what we were doing. We acted in ignorance. And now we have to grow up. We have to grow up and admit our mistakes. Now, there's a lot of people that make a lot of money selling to those mistakes. They're not really interested in that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, the solutions proposed from top down are always just to make more money for certain people and to set us off the path, it feels like. But if we just align with nature, if we just start doing the patterns, following the way things worked. I mean, this book, when I wrote it, the first thing I did was figure out how did soils form in the first place? And then how do soils continuously form? And the reality is it's, we haven't done that work on a large scale. And once we do, we see such a huge reaction because it's been missing. And the reality is, if we do this work, we only have like 10, 20 years of work to do, and then we will arrive at a new place, and you'll have plenty of soil organic matter. You'll have mineral coherency. You'll have the biology that sticks season to season. That's literally what regenerative means. Regenerative, if you look it up in the Bible, is synonymous with resurrection, which is what happens every spring. That's why Easter happens when it happens, right? Things come back. And it's always this miracle of spring. And so those microbes come back. They're regenerative. And what are you supposed to do then? Well, you're supposed to enjoy it at that point, right?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, our farmers suddenly have this momentum that's ubiquitous. Everyone's like, oh, yeah, we've got like 20, 30 organic matter. Our soils are coherent. We know what to spoon feed it biologically. We know what to spoon feed it mineral wise. We do the cover crops, and we're disease resistant. We're at genetic full potential of expression every year now. And so there is actual like place we arrive to. That's the thing about the people are like, oh, the soil thing is just like, it's not endless, actually. There's a destination. And then we can stay in that regenerative state and just enjoy the good food, enjoy our farmers being profitable, having their actual nutrient density get up to where it belongs and stay there. And when people talk about, you know, food is our medicine, it used to be.
Yeah.
But it certainly hasn't been since it's so nutrient deficient. And so bringing these things back is possible. It all starts with the soil. But once we start on this path, there is a finish. There is a place at where we will arrive.
You know, and just I want to preface what I'm about to say with you've got people in your audience listening to me that probably never heard of me before today. And if they know I do a show called The Survival Podcast, you might think that I do things that scare people, and I don't. I'm an incredible optimist. I talk about preparedness because it makes sense. I think if you have car insurance, that's great, but you have a family to feed, you probably should have some food insurance because you just don't know. So what I'm about to say is not scaremongering. I think Matt's timeline, if we do the right work 20 years, we can fix it. The alternative is we do nothing, and in 40 years, your grandchildren and your great-grandchildren will fucking starve. Okay? That's your two choices here. Like, we can let movies like Soylent Green become the future, or we can build the future. And if you just look at what has happened in a century and a half of doing things this way, then forecasting what another 40 years does to it isn't hard. It's not like this is confusing if you don't want it to be. We are destroying the very thing that keeps us alive. I'm not saying the human race will get wiped out. I'm saying the suffering will be massive. And there is no need for it to happen. Like, the stuff we're talking about and the work that other people are doing, like John Kemp, like Ray Archuleta, like Gabe Brown, like, it's not just us, guys. There's a whole team of people working in different ways to make this not happen, and we're starting to make headway. The problem that we have as a species is when things get good, we're like, nah, we don't need to worry about it. It's going to be okay. And so, like, things can seem okay when they're not, and you see a few farmers doing cover crops, and you think like the victory is around the corner, you have to stay full press on, because the people that are behind keeping things the way they are, they have not billions of dollars, they have trillions of dollars. They have all of the authorities in their pocket through regulatory capture, and you need renegades. You need, I mean, the act of growing your own food today is insurrectionist. You want an insurrection? That's your insurrection. And I've been using that word for a long-ass time, long before everybody used it to attack the orange man. And my differential between a revolution and an insurrection, a revolution is when people rise up, take power from one group of people and give it to another, right, and say, now you rule us. An insurrection is where people say, enough of your shit, I'm taking the power, and no one else gets it. We're done with this. This is us now. We're running things shot off. And how do you put down an insurrection or a revolution? Either one. Starve your enemy out. I'm sorry, you don't get to starve us. You don't get to starve us because we're providing our own food. So that's not going to work. You can't go roaming and burn the fields or anything like that on millions of individuals in their own backyard trading with their neighbors. Like, that is untenable. That doesn't work. We need to see ourselves as what we are, this remnant who has gone back and found what was left for us and takes modern technology and goes forward with it. And if we don't understand that that's what we are, we will lose, because the surest way you lose a battle is to not understand your enemy, not understand your place, and to be overconfident, right? And so then you don't do the work. We have a ton of work to do. And if we don't do it, no one else is gonna.
Yeah. Yeah, but it is the case that we can do it. It's the things that need to be done are so obvious once you understand the way soil works. It's all doable, whether we're making minerals that we're providing minerals that are micronutrients and things that are difficult, you know what I mean, to get into your soil. You're feeding them to your worms, and then they're making worm castings, and then now it's easy to add to your soil. There's so many ways that we can go down this path and functionally adapt, and they're doing it. Farmers are doing it right now. The American wheat, just grains in general, is at 15% regenerative ag, and they're all planning on switching. The largest buyer in U.S. grains is demanding that they make it regenerative because they're still family owned to do that. They predicted it'll take 15 to 20 years to get the whole U.S. grain onto regenerative. That's why I see that number. And so when they do that, though, there's no going back, because the farmer will be free from all the excess chemicals, the pesticides, the spray and use the GMO things. All of that's ending, and they're losing control. And that's why you see all these power grabs. That's why you see all this craziness. That's why you see farmers being attacked, you know, in Europe. And there's precedent for this. This is what happened in Russia when they killed all the farmers and everyone starved and there was cannibalism. This has happened throughout history. Soylent Green is in many ways a metaphor.
Yes.
You know what I mean? But what happens when society breaks down? We start cannibalizing. And right now, look at what happened during COVID to the businesses. Like, larger businesses ate the market share of smaller businesses. Amazon literally just cannibalized the majority of U.S. businesses. And they're trying to do that right now with U.S. food. So they're outlawing things. They're doing lawfare to try to make it so that you can have backyard chickens. They're trying to... Certain areas they're already trying to prevent, you know, seed swaps. And it's this pushback that is, it calls us all to stand up and be like, no, we stand with the farmers. No, we stand with the seeds. No, we stand with nature. Because it's very, very serious, very, very real. The precedent is there. It's happening in real time. They're trying to shut down the food. They're trying to make it so that there's a food crisis. And if we grow our own food, there is no crisis. And in fact, what happens in that gap is a shifting of power. And that's really what they don't want. They don't want to do the rug pull and then have all of us set up. So we're like, okay, all right, okay, we're now providing. Here's eggs for the neighbor. And we're suddenly the economic engine again of our local economy, of our neighborhood. And it's a different economy. It's a truer economy. It's dislocated from Wall Street. And that's what they're really afraid of. But that's going to be our saving grace, because we have all these things. They're going to do this. And not only that, it seems like it's on the 6 month to 9 month calendar. You know what I mean? For a collapse of some sort to happen.
Yeah.
And so being ready, having these things in place, actually provides us with that pivot so that we can suddenly have, you know, a community that feels connected, feels warm. People know each other. People rely upon each other and trust each other, because they actually do. rely upon each other.
Yeah.
They trust you because they love your food. You know, they know your food. And it's so simple and basic, but that's the truth. This is the basic building blocks of our lives, of our community. So it starts with soil, but it extends and touches everything.
And we can either side with nature or we can side with that system. It's a binary decision, I believe, at this point. And I think people come at this and get very depressed because when they start realizing how big of a thing we're trying to move, it seems insurmountable. But the picture I have for those on the audio up right now is my hand with a tiny little frog on my fingertip. You know what's more powerful than ConAgra, Bayer, Monsanto, all these? That little frog is more powerful than those fuckers. I'm sorry it is, because that little frog is one. And I did it. You've seen my aquatic system on the back of my chicken house, which is made up of some tanks and one big in-ground pond. Conservative estimate, this spring when that picture was taken, there were 20,000 of those little frogs in just that one system. And so you can side with the system that can take a pond system that's a couple of years old, that's built out of junk, basically, that can produce 20,000 frogs. Or you can side with the system that sprays chemicals, in Alex Jones' word, to turn the frogs gay, right? Like, I mean, and he's taking a lot of shit for that, but and I don't think it's really gay, but what it's going to shut down their ability to reproduce. Like, if you want to know if you have a healthy system, when you have lots of amphibians in your system, I promise you, you have a healthy system.
Yeah,
they are the canary in the coal mine. When you're amphibians, they go away before the reptiles. They go away before they go away before everything. And when you start finding, like, I have freaking bullfrogs that are, like, been living in some of my tanks for 5 years, and they're huge, and there's no surface water within 2 miles. And I didn't put them there. We had a year where it rained every day in May. We had 29 days of rain in May, of, like, measurable rainfall. And we had turtles walking through our, like, water turtles walking through the pasture. And the frogs showed, like, pickerel frogs, leopard frogs, and bullfrogs showed up, and they colonized these aquatic systems. Okay, nature did that with a little assist from us. We can either side with nature. I have another picture. I couldn't find it that I really wanted to put up there, and it's from last year when Darth and I went to California, and we went into the forest to see the redwoods and the sequoias and all. And there was a guy about a half a mile walk from the place we stayed, and he was harvesting the fallen dead redwoods. And he had some huge logs that probably were 1,000-year-old trees that had naturally died, because that's the only legal way to do it now. And he had them sitting out and slabbed so that he could sell them later. And he had one that was like the end piece that I guess he couldn't make a slab out of. He was figuring out what to do. And it's sitting there. And on the top of this stump that was, you know, 4 foot off the ground, there's a black spruce tree growing in that stump. And I have used that as the image at the end of, like, every presentation I've done in person since I took that picture. And I'm like, nature is undefeated. That little black spruce will eat that giant trunk, grow for a couple, 300 years, die, and in its place, a new redwood will rise. And if we're all gone, that's still going to happen.
Yeah.
And so who do you want your ally to be? Do you want that? Do you want the little frog is your ally, or do you want, you know, ConAgra and Bayer, who's now absorbed Monsanto? Do you want glyphosate as your ally, or do you want nature as your ally? And I think that if you put it that binary, it's pretty easy to make that call. You want to take some questions, Matt?
Sure. Yeah, it's awesome. I see Stephen Reisner's here in the comments. Thank you for being here, Stephen.
Hey, Steve, we need to get him on with both of us sometime. That's
absolutely.
There he is, the famous Stephen Reisner. Let's take some questions, though. If you have any questions, guys, all caps for the word question at least. And I'll come around one more time at the end of these. The Santos Live says, I can't grow cucurbits in my garden. Severe stem rot from the soil based on my research. Some sort of virus in the soil. Please, 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 what do I do? The soil is sick.
Yeah, so I'd want to know, first of all, what's going on in your soil in terms of, like, what's there, what's not there. I would assess it. And then, I mean, this is how I do everything. Mm-hmm. But just to give you something to start with, even though I don't know what's going on, I would hit that with EM. I would hit that with kelp. The reality is if you water with those two things, that can help it. But if your stem rot from the soil, if you already have damage to the stem at the soil base,
yeah,
that's going to be really hard for it to work because that's the pump. That's the tube to the, yeah, the pump for your nutrients. So this, all the advice I'm going to give here is going to be to focus on saving the plants. But if you've got damage to your stems at the base, that's going to be very hard to like just come back from.
Agreed. I've never had this, Matt, so I'm wondering if it is, and I'd want to know the age of the plant. Mm-hmm. Is this some sort of insect damage that's then creating a vector of attack, like cutworms that aren't going all the way through or something like that? Because I've never had like a healthy cucumber plant and then the stem rots. So like, is this plant a foot tall or 3 foot tall when this begins? Because I've seen a lot of shit go wrong with cucurbits. I've seen a lot of squash bug damage, cucumber beetles transporting diseases, but I've never seen a stem of a cucumber rot. Now, he said cucurbits, so the first thing we need is cucumbers. If he's talking squash, you might have squash vine borer.
Yeah, you know, the funny thing is,
not a plant, right? So Santos, let us know. Do you mean squash? Because if you got squash and the stems are looking like they're rotted, pull them open. I bet there's a maggot in there about as big around as your pinky tip, and that's squash vine borer.
Yeah. Yeah, so I've actually, because of what I do, I never have any of those kinds of things. So the number one thing that's everywhere here is grasshoppers.
Like, yeah.
100 grasshoppers per square foot, kind of.
Yeah.
And so the moment that that calcium stops pumping, they can munch on those leaves.
Yeah.
So that's the one thing I see here, and they just, like, wait. They're, like, all just, like, waiting until the moment arrives. So I have to just keep doing foliar sprays pretty regularly to keep them from doing that. But other than that, I've never had squash vine borer. Back in the day in California, I would have the powdery mildew and those kinds of things. I don't have those anymore because of what I feed my plants and how I amend the soil. So if your plant is having sufficient boron, silicon, and calcium, you're not going to have the ability for things to break through like that. And then worst case scenario, you're having an infestation. I would check out the IPMO video that I have on my YouTube with Chris Trump. He created this protocol. It's so simple, so easy. Again, simple tech has such power. Because that's how nature works.
Is that the IPMO stuff?
Yeah.
Where you're
basically
cultivating fungus that eats the exoskeleton and mummifies stuff. That was the stuff Stephen gave away at the workshop on how to make it.
Yeah, it's so easy to do. And so we all can collect things and we all can we can then direct things. So yeah. So I really value what we're doing simply because so many of the problems that my students have, I'm like, oh, well, I don't have that problem. And it's like, I understand why I don't have that problem, but I don't. And so I can help you. You know what I mean? And so I really, really value EM or the biofertilizers that make up EM. Steven's in the comments talking about lab right now. And that's lactic acid bacteria. And that's one of the main effective ingredients in EM. Yeast, cerveza yeast is also another effective ingredient. Cerveza yeast is an endophyte in all these plants that we know that we ferment into alcohol. It was already inside the plant. It's one of the most common yeasts. That the endophytes, I should say, in plants, yeast are in general, and cerveza yeast is a dominant one. So alcohol would have already happened. It was inside the grape. It was inside the plants to begin with. So the yeast, the lab, and then the purple non-silver bacteria, what we were alluding to before that you can get from your pond water. Those kinds of things, just taking those endophytes can make your plant strong enough that it can process and not need anything else. But if you have deficiencies in the soil, then it's like adding oil to your engine, adding like coolant and all this stuff. It's like, yeah, but if you don't have gas, it's still not going to run, you know? So you need to have everything there, yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah. For your thing to work. So I love lab. I love using all these ingredients. And it is the case that if you're missing something fundamental, that these things can work okay, but the second you stop using them, it's like, it's back again. You're missing it in the soil, and you're just adding it in little bits with your foliar, so you need to address the soil.
Gotcha. And Santos is in my audience. I know that. I recognize his handle. So if you want to email me, jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com, TSPC in the subject line, give me more specifics, what we see we can do in the future, because there's a lot of unknowns in that. And again, cucurbits, do we mean squash with a great big fat, juicy vine borer attracting stem, or do we mean a cucumber? Because my answer is going to be different based on that alone. Brandon says, what about biochar spread in the woods for a period before putting it in the garden? You could do that. My opinion of that is, though, that's going to be a lot of work to get it back. Like, put it in your compost. Like, yeah. What would you say?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. It's too much work. I mean, if you want to do like an IMO collection in the woods and then combine that with your biochar, that would be cool.
Yeah.
Super cool. But yeah, and I would do that as part of like IMO3, you know what I mean? As an ingredient.
Yeah. You know, but if you put it in your compost, it's done, bro. I put it in my compost, but I also add it every time I spread a new bale of straw in my chicken house, my duck house, I add like a half a bucket of biochar. So it's right in the feedstock, but it's also in there. So the birds are going in there and they're picking it out. They eat it. Like animals eat charcoal. It used to be in poultry feed. When you bought poultry feed, there was like 5-10% biochar in there because it will improve the feed efficiency by 20%. The feed manufacturers went to the government and asked them to regulate it out of the feed because the customers wanted it because they knew that, so they could sell you more feed.
Yeah.
Right? Like, so if you really want the best way to inoculate biochar, put it through an animal. Put it through a worm. Put it through a cow. Put it through a chicken. Put it through a goat. Put it through a duck. Once it goes through that, it's on, man. I mean, you've made steroid biochar.
And it's also good for those
forest. It's too much work.
Yeah, and it's also really good for those animals. Feeding biochar to pigs is considered a best practice for their health.
Yep. Like I said, it'll improve feed efficiency. And any sort of toxin, this is something people need to understand, though, in their digestive tract, it will absorb and take out. Once it's in your blood, charcoal will do nothing for you. It has to be able to make contact with a toxin. But adsorption is what we're doing here. And it's really important you understand that. So absorb, AD, is what it does with water. Adsorb is what it does with toxins, nutrients, and other things, where it literally sticks to it. It's not so much as being pulled inside. It sticks to it like a magnet. That's the best way to think of it. There's a question here from the same dude, and I don't know if maybe it's for you because I don't know this term, or maybe it's a typo. What about maying? M-A-I-N-G. Is that something I don't know and you do, or is it a typo?
I think it's a typo.
Okay. So if you want to clarify that, Brandon, we'll come back to it. This is from one of my prior streams, but since Larry super chatted me $20, I'm going to cover it. He said, the last stream I attended, I mentioned insulin defiant. You took that to mean insulin resistance. What I mean is the opposite of insulin dependent. I have reversed my type 2 diabetes without medication. That was probably from the stream I had with Dr. Ken Berry, and we were talking about that. I'm not sure what he means by insulin defiant, even with that comment, but what I said in that stream, and I believe it to be true, is there is no such thing as type 2 diabetes. It's the wrong term. It's insulin resistance is what I was talking about, meaning your body makes insulin, but it has to keep making more and more to do the same job because you're constantly over-sugaring your body. And if you want to get fat, eat the food pyramid because it's literally a bag of cow feed is our food pyramid. So I'm not really sure what he's still saying there. I'm glad he reduced his diabetes, eliminated it. I mean, that's what we should be doing. We should type 2 diabetes, if we're going to call it that. Every doctor should be talking about how to reverse it completely, not how to treat it. Treating it is how they make money off of it. Treating it is why there's a company called DaVita. I don't know if you know this company, Matt, but they make dialysis equipment. That's the only thing they do. So they make dialysis equipment, and they run like the small little dialysis labs where you have to go on continuous dialysis for your kidneys until they find you in a kidney. And the only way they make money is if people are in kidney failure. They have partnered with the American Diabetes Association to provide recipes for diabetics to help their kidney health, which includes things like cranberry oatmeal cookies. This is like the unholy alliance of Satan himself. I mean, and so that's where that's coming from. But yeah, can you imagine that you're telling a diabetic, if you think I'm kidding, put in DaVita, D-A-V-I-T-A in Google or any other search engine, DaVita diabetic recipes, and go look at it. I'm not going to pull it up today, but.
And they also ratchet them so high on their medication that they have to have sugar to continue staying alive.
Yeah.
And so they don't move it down so that they can move off the sugar. They keep it high so they stay on the sugar.
And Homestead Heathen, not really a question, but if you super chat me, you get featured. Just showing appreciation for this amazing content. I've been listening to Jack since just after the Jetta days. For those in Matt's audience, I actually started my podcast at 18 months in my car until I walked away from corporate America. And he says, thank you for introducing me to Matt. Absolutely. Matt is one of my heroes in this space. Hey, Alabama said, I told someone at a farmer's market last week that I don't ask permission to do things. She looked at me like I was a disease, and she said she was a rule follower, and I said, okay.
Oh, dear. Well, America was founded on the opposite.
Yeah, I love when they say Happy Independence Day, and I'm like, don't you mean Insurrection Day? The 4th of July is Insurrection Day. It's not Independence Day. We didn't become independent on the 4th of July. We declared it, but then we had to fight a war for 8 freaking years. The people are like the actual war was less than 8 years, but it actually started in 1775, and we didn't actually get like a total agreement with England to leave us the fuck alone. For 8 years after that happened, it took 8 years to become independent. We had an insurrection, and actually the insurrection was on, if you want to be technically accurate, my birthday, August 2nd of 1776, was when the last signature went on the Declaration. But yeah, I am not a rule follower. I probably would have given the same, like, once you tell me I'm a rule follower, okay. Like, I don't really have anything else to add to that. There's nothing. You're not ready yet. I mean, that's like, you're not ready for the training. Go back and come back later on. Your cup is too full. Take whatever ancient metaphor you need to understand that. Next question, Dead Rider. After termination of a crop and you have a residue that you're going to tarp, okay, that's a valid termination method if you choose it. What are your thoughts on putting a BSL bin spread under the tarp to devour the residue? One, unnecessary. Two, it will not work, because you're going to end up primarily with a lignin residue, and BSL want nothing to do with lignin. They're not worms. They're maggots. They want living or just recently – actually, they want recently deceased organic matter, right? They what a BSL really wants is a dead deer in the middle of the woods. That's what it really wants. But it'll do certain vegetation if it's fresh, or fruit if it's fresh. Like, I fed Azolla to BSLs, and they eat it, like, instantly. But if you dry it and throw it in there, they don't touch it. They don't want anything to do with my opinion. What are your thoughts on that, Matt?
Yeah, so the thing is, you're going to have too fast a nitrate release, too, with that. And so it's going to release all that nitrogen, and you're going to have a flush of biology and then a die-off because they're going to run out of fuel. And so it's going to take you off on a weird direction, and it's not going to be not going to build. What happens when you have a huge flush of nitrogen, especially nitrate, in soil is it does what it does in your compost, the carbon to nitrogen ratio.
Mm-hmm.
So when you do a huge flush of nitrogen release, you actually release the carbon in the soil and ruin your soil organic matter to a degree. So you start eating away at your actual structure.
Okay.
And so that's why when we want to add nitrogen, it's best as an amino acid, best to, when it's combined with organic matter or something, it's a form of organic nitrogen, right? So ideally, that's what we want to do. This is why a lot of farmers now are wary to just add on manure straight. That's why fermentation is becoming more and more popularized, because then it's amino acids they're adding, not nitrates. So I would say I would primp it so that you've got that longer term changeover. And then the tarping thing, the black plastic tarps, what makes plastic pliable is plastic softeners like BPA and other things. And when you have it sit in the sun, like in our climates, and see it break up into those little chips and it becomes fragile and breaks up, what was making it pliable gassed off.
Correct.
And it gasses off into the soil. And so I maybe you get a canvas tarp, right? Traditional cannabis tarp. That's awesome. That's what all the sails on the ships in the Navy are made of. Awesome. But unless it's something like that, that's really problematic. Or if it's canvas that has been sprayed with like flame retardants or something terrible, you have to be careful. So I would question what you're doing, why you're doing it. Why do you need it to be that fast? And if you really do want it to be that fast, I would do it I would do it differently.
Let me add on to that with, if you're using a tarp, it's part of termination, and I do teach this, but again, my course is not yet released. It's still being developed. And so you have incomplete information if you've heard me mention it as an aside. Tarping a cover crop is something that I would do for maximum 2 to 3 weeks. And it's right after termination. And the only reason I'm going to do that is I'm not ready to plant my next crop yet. And I don't want stand up and regrowth of my cover. So I'm going to put that cover to the ground where it makes ground contact. I have active soil. I'm going to let the soil do that work. I'm only tarping that long enough to deny light to that plant. So the termination takes, and it's going to come off, and it's all going to, I want that residue on the surface of the soil for as long as possible, because in my spring, when I pull that residue back, it's micro and macro arthropods everywhere. I don't want it to go away any faster than it does on its own. And then I might even, like when I plant, especially if I'm not doing seed-based plant, if I'm doing set outs, I'm probably going to wood mulch on top of that to help keep that suppression down, because especially in where do you live, what was your cover crop, everything's context. But like in our climate, a lot of things in that spring will come back up. And I don't mind a little bit of triticale or a little bit of pea, because I know as soon as the heat comes, it's going to give up anyway. What I don't want is like 50% of what I put to the ground standing back up. And so if you guys have heard me mention tarping, I'm not talking about tarping it until the residue is gone. I'm talking about just making sure the termination sticks. And in certain mixes that you will use, and like everything's about timing. So sometimes I'm going to need this dead by this date to put my tomatoes, peppers, and eggplants out. And it's not really ready to terminate. For instance, if I'm doing a grass, when I terminate a grass like a wheat or a triticale or a barley or an oat, I want it in the milk stage for ideal termination. I want the seed to start to form. But it's not hard. If I squeeze it, milky substance come out. That's what they call it. If you crimp that at that stage, it's done.
Yep.
But, it's not there yet. Or if I let it go, it's going to set full on seed. It's going to reseed. I'm going to lose all the value because it's going to start drawing from its battery and making straw and seed instead of that vegetative matter. So I need to kill it now and it ain't ready. So I'll do something combining. I'll do a crimp and a flame. And I figured out this year, yeah, dummy, flame it and then crimp it. Don't do it the other way around. But the tarp, if you start having stand-up, and I usually don't tarp the whole bed. You have certain areas where you're like, oh, that spot is going to be a pain in the ass. And I have these shelter halves, USGI shelter halves made out of canvas, and I'll throw that over there and weight it down just in that one spot until I'm ready to plant it. And that will prevent that stand back up. So I think there might be some confusion there.
Yeah, no, that's great. That's awesome. I think that if you have a profuse enough cover crop, especially if it's leaning towards annuals and you crimp it, it'll break down really well as well if you have enough time. That's why I said, you know, time is your constraint. I know for a lot of people who are really, really aggressive, they're changing over the crops that day. They're, mm-hmm. you know, they it's like Curtis Stone is the person I'm thinking of.
Yeah.
He's going to be hyper aggressive, burn that down, clear that out, you know, or tarp it for, like Jean-Martin Fortier, tarp it for 2 weeks
yeah.
aggressively. You know what I mean? It's almost like he's doing, it's almost like because of the moisture levels that they're doing like chaffy hay or like a ferment, you know what I mean? Essentially.
Yeah.
And then he removes that and then he tills that under, right? So he doesn't yeah. even like in that, he tills it under. So there's a lot of ways you can do this. It's effective. All these different ways that we've described, they're all effective. It just depends on your equipment. It depends on your timing. It depends on your trade-offs. Almost everything's a trade-off.
Next? What are you doing right? next? What's your climate type? Is it going to summer or winter kill in a couple weeks anyway? Like, that's why I put a course together on it, because I keep getting questions like this, and it's like, well, it depends. And then there's like 50 things it depends on. And until you get context down, and I think one of the places people really miss it is you have so much of a desire for technique and tactic that people lose strategy. So we have to start with strategy, which is the overriding goal. This is my goal. Then we have techniques, which a cover crop mix is a technique. And then we have a tactic. When it's applied, how it's terminated, what comes next, those all dictate tactics. And until you see that timeline play out, what happens is everybody sees something like, you know, 15 years ago, Paul Wheaton tells the world about hugel culture and everybody's building a hugel mound. No idea why or what. Just, hey, Paul said you don't have to water. Well, if you put a hugel mound out in the middle of a very dry climate isolated by itself, it won't work.
Yeah.
I don't care what Paul says. Paul's in Montana, right? Right. Paul's in Montana. Paul gets 19 hours of daylight during the summer. And even though it's not a high rain environment, it is an environment that is very good at conserving moisture. You know what Central Texas is like. It's not the same. So everything hinges off the strategy, then the technique, and then the tactic, and then how the techniques are assembled with tactics to deliver a final result. Moving on, so we keep going here because it's about 2 hours now. Oops says, Jack, when did you start the Survival Podcast? 2010, been with you since the beginning. That would be 2008. 16 years this June, June 20th, 2008, we did our first episode. You don't need to linger on that one. Matt, what are your thoughts on human purpose being the wound that gets embedded so deep into the ecosystem in order to be the antidote?
Yeah, so Zach Bush was, I was like with Zach Bush when he was doing like the gut biome stuff. I love okay. that. I'm still there. Then he started getting a little woo.
Okay.
And I'm not there with the woo. But I do think that meaning is just the issue. If you read Man's Search for Meaning, it's a really excellent short book. Logotherapy is actually what should have replaced psychotherapy and all the Freudian nonsense. You know what I mean? Meaning is what civilizes. Meaning is what makes people rise above their basic nature. It's meaning that's been missing. So I think that if people have an understanding of their relationship with the ecosystem, they'll get meaningful, interactions out of it. And what you have is people being told that they're, you know, part of this cancer, and so they see themselves as the problem. They don't see a meaningful connection with themselves and nature. And so they see themselves as the detriment. And so getting in touch with nature, finding out what our purpose is, having a meaningful life, makes it so that you recognize our place in nature. It makes it so that you recognize your place in the community and in the world. It's grounding. So I think that building meaning, doing things that are meaningful, fixes the wound. And in stride with that, just people understanding and knowing how the world works, the ecosystems will be taken care of as well. I think that's what permaculture in a large part is. They're getting you to see the meaning in nature and your connection to it. And you suddenly are like, wow, these dung beetles are moving this. So these little insects suddenly have meaning for you. And you're like, oh, so amazing. And then you're like noticing this process, and it's the meaning of that process that gives it value to you as you observe it. So again, it's meaning. So I suggest reading that book, check out my books, and look for what resonates with you, what calls out to you. And, those solutions are waiting.
My short answer on that, so we can keep going, is that human beings are as native to this planet as any other species. It's when we stop behaving like what human beings really are that we start to cause problems. So it is not natural to build giant cities and put 6 million people into an area that can comfortably support 60,000. And when we start behaving that way, we start becoming a problem in our natural state, that we've spent way more time as a species on this planet in our natural state than in our current state. We are a beneficial organism in the system, which is why we lasted, right? We literally can expand life, and we can expand abundance if we understand the system we're in. If we don't start changing things before we understand what we're looking at, and if we do, it always ends badly. Seth says, what is the average time between foliar sprays? When, what, why, context, right? So right now for me, I'm spraying every 2 weeks. In the spring, I hardly do it at all. In the fall, I hardly do it at all. It's one more thing to do. The plants are happy. Why would I do anything? And depending on where you are, what you're growing, what your issues are, what your deficiencies are, that number could change.
Yeah, and especially what minerals. The more macro a nutrient is, the less you can add it in heavy doses. Mm. Think about adding nitrogen in a heavy dose as a foliar. You burn the plant. So it's really about, and it's more efficient to do it with foliar, totally. So you can do less, you know what I mean, nitrogen, and get more in the plant by doing it through foliar spray, but you have to do it in spoon feeding. So if obviously if it's like molybdenum, or if it's something that's a micronutrient, you may only be doing this once or twice. But when it's a macronutrient and you're doing foliar, it has to be added way more often. And if you look at it, like to go to really extreme, the aeroponics thing, right? They've got constantly spraying nutrients mm-hmm. on those, you mm-hmm. know? And so you can go to the extreme of it and be like, it's stuck without it. You know what I mean? It needs those little bits. And that's why we need soil to provide that foundation, that economy that's always feeding. And then foliar is really to fix problems, to supplement, to fill in gaps, and to get you to another place. So foliar is very useful, but we can't forget the soil. And just to go back to that last question, it occurred to me as you answered that, I mean, our oldest story, Adam and Eve, they didn't obey a law of the forest. They violated a law of the jungle or of nature and had a fall from grace. So in other words, we're continuing that fall.
Oh, and then they were sent out to the fields to farm.
Right.
You screwed up nature, and now you got to be a farmer and sweat in the field. Might be a lesson in that.
And their firstborn was killed by their secondborn. And when the secondborn was cursed, he had to go live in the city.
Yeah. 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 Right. Yes. And his punishment was never dying.
Uh-huh.
Right.
But which is never in the cities. Right. I just think about all that. I think about that a lot. And it does tie into our deep, our deeper selves, our meaningful selves, our past. But that's what we're bringing back. We're bringing back this deeply meaningful connection with nature, fixing something that's ancient, that is, you know, like she said, a wound in everyone. That's one way to think about it.
Yeah, yeah. Andy D, I'm going to give the short version of it. Basically, he lives in a neighborhood. He's put a bunch of gardens in. He's out of space for composting, and he wants to know how to compost without the HOA on his back. I'm shilling my own course here, but if you are, and if you want to email me, I'll give you this. I just don't have time to get an image up. I have a trash can composter that was basically my first bioreactor before I knew what a bioreactor was. It's really easy. You use like a 40-gallon tough trash can that you get for like $30 at Home Depot and Lowe's. Put a pipe in the middle of it, cut some holes in it. If you don't want certain things getting in it, you can overlay the holes. Use a hole saw to make them with like a hardware cloth or something. But the point of that is you could set up 20 of these and it just looks like you have garbage cans for your waste. Like they don't look like anything but a garbage can. It is not my preferred method anymore. But since I developed it 16 years ago, I can tell you it works. And if you're stuck in that situation, just make things look pretty and blue hair leave you alone. I mean, that's what I could say there, right? Like make it like they don't see it. They don't know to bitch about it. And don't, for God's sakes, don't tell them you did it because you have no idea. Like you, it's almost like this. There was an episode of South Park where one of the kids found out they were actually from New Jersey and they started like mutating into like a Jersey Shore character as soon as they knew it. You have no idea who is a blue hair. Like just because they don't have blue hair doesn't mean they're not a blue hair, right? You tell them what you're doing and next thing you know, you're getting like we have friends. I don't know what's wrong with them. They moved to like an old folks community, like 55 and up gated community. And to make extra money, the guy walks around at night and writes tickets for people who park in the street. Like, if you could stay away from that shit, stay away from that shit, man. You don't need that.
That's just bad. I mean, it's detrimental to that person's character to be. That's awful.
You're writing tickets. He said they don't get fined unless they get like 3 tickets or something. It's like, why do you care if somebody parks in the road of their own house, right? If they're parked in your, you know, like blocking your driveway or something, I get it, but. Just be don't if you're if something's working for you in a neighborhood, don't tell your neighbors about it. Leave it alone. Keep it on the down low. How do you stop grasshoppers and squash vine borers? That's from Matt Turner. I know him. He lives close to you, by the way, Matt, kind of to the west of you. Squash vine borers, I still have some issues with. I have found that catnip growing around the base of squash drastically reduces their impact, and even if you grow it somewhere else, literally cutting it and laying it like mulch, I don't know what it is about catnip, but they do not care for it. Grasshoppers, my solution to grasshoppers are they quack and they go all over the place. I have no, like, when I see a grasshopper that makes it into the garden, I just start calling the ducks and I start shaking, and then they come out and then they're just devoured, right? So like what did Bill Mollison say? You don't have a slug problem or a snail problem, you have a duck deficiency. You don't have a grasshopper problem, you have a duck deficiency. Like, ducks and chickens, it's a massacre every day in the summer. As soon as everything dries up and the grasshoppers really come in, it's like watching a wolf pack, except the wolves are this big.
Yeah.
Moving around, and, like, they'll literally eat till they can't eat anymore, and then they lay in the shade, and then, like, one will be like, I'm hungry again, and get up and quack, and, like, if nobody's ready to go, ducks won't go alone. There'll have to be at least like 6 of them that agree with their little quack talk. Hey, it's time to go do this again. And they'll just massacre all day long, all summer long. Another bird.
And you got dogs. How many dogs do you have protecting them?
Two. But another bird that will massacre grasshoppers, even better than ducks, turkeys. And they look big and goofy and stupid, and they look like they can barely move. But when they go to get a grasshopper, the speed, they remind me of rattlesnakes because a rattlesnake is big. It doesn't crawl very fast once it's grown. It just kind of sits there. But the speed they can strike with is breathtaking. And turkeys are like that. Turkeys are just dum-da-dum, and then boom, like Grandmaster Splinter or some shit, foot to face. And that thing is gone. Muscovies, same way. Muscovies, when the flies come to the duck coop in the spring – if you have muscovies, it sounds like popcorn in there. they'll all kind of just wander back to the coop once you open the door and the flies come in, and it just, and you go back and there's no flies. They will devour anything that gets near them. So I like to use animal integration. And grasshoppers, I never had a problem with until that plant stressed. I don't know about you.
That's, I mean, that's what it is. It's like when your plant's stressed, what does that mean? It's low in something. And so it's calcium. That's the majority of the issues that I see with having grasshopper damage in our area. It's just the water-soluble calcium that you need to spray. And then squash vine borer, I just think that's a deficiency issue. And I just haven't seen it because of what I do. There's also different varieties. If it becomes a real problem that you can't control and you don't have the ability to buy things to change it, you also just grow the
Mixa. It's the species that Tromboschino is in.
Mm-hmm.
It's gooseneck pumpkin, butternut squash, Tromboschino squash. They grow, and I can't remember if it's Mixa or Maxima, whatever it is.
Rampicante is in that. They're brown skinned. They're light, like tannish, adobe brown skinned squash. And so it's the butternut, you know, color, right?
Butternut, Tromboschino. But their stem is so dense. And I have seen them attacked by vine borers, but I've never seen vine borers successfully kill them.
Huh.
Because what they really want isn't in there. They want a big, juicy, like a zucchini, like a regular bush zucchini. They'll murder that because it's exactly what they're looking for. The family that butternut, long neck, Tromboschino, all of that stuff's in, they just don't really like it.
Yeah. Yeah, I've definitely seen that. And so that's like, that's a choice you could make. But I also have, I mean, those Queensland blue, you can see that those are the juicy stems.
Yeah.
Those are the ones with the wide veins. They've got all those entry points. They kind of crack and open up, you know? But even then, I'm not seeing that as an issue. And it's because of the nutrition, because of the soil, and also because of that foliar spraying regimen. And
I also think they're a very regional pest. Like where I grew up in Pennsylvania, literally people dumped zucchini. Like that's not a joke if you ever hear about it. Like taking a bag of zucchini and sticking it in a car because your neighbor was too stupid to put their windows up in the summer. And so you could, because you had too much of it. Like that's actually a thing. Until I moved to Texas, I didn't know what a squash vine borer was. I never saw one. I had no idea. And I'd come out and my squash would all have like these limp leaves in the middle of the day, and you water the shit out of them at night and it comes back and it just keeps getting progressively worse. And finally you find it looks like sawdust, and then you open that stem and it's just devastated. And so I think that where you live will actually have a big impact on how much of that you see anyway. But I've tried injectable nematode even, and that didn't do shit. Like they make nematodes that are specific to squash vine borer grubs. You can literally inject it into the vine of the squash. I think it sells really good, but I don't think it works. I think it sells really good one time. My approach here, and I have very healthy plants, so I don't know that maybe there's still something missing, but my approach here is to do what you said. I grow things that they don't like. I grow Tromboschino, right? And I will grow, like I'll get zucchini. And the other, so the approach conventionally, and it works, is you just grow a shitload of squash. People that grow squash on a farm do not care about squash vine borers. Sure, they'll kill 10% of the crop. They don't care. It grows so fast. It's so prolific. So I think the main reason it screws us as gardeners is we grow one or two plants. Well, when that pest shows up, that's all it has. So it goes all in on it.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I grow so much. I mean, I've got bunnies, chipmunks, squirrels, moles, you know, all these things. And then I got the access deer and all those other things coming in. And so I've got some squash that are being eaten right now, and I didn't remove them. I'm like, well, you started. I'll let you finish. Just focus on this. Don't leave my other things alone. Because, I mean, an access deer or a chipmunk, they're going to eat the good food. There's not like a mineral combination that's like going to affect an animal. They're just like us. And so I grow a volume of things. I grow so much of things, and it makes a huge difference. Every place I've been recently has been so fire prone that I tend to avoid things like hot wires and things that potentially could like create a fire if I did wrong. Or if there's, an animal that dies on something. But I've always just done volume, and it's served me really well. I started growing with right outside Yosemite with no fences, and we had deer walking through the gardens all the time. But I was always able to get huge yields because I think a lot of it's the swales. When you do something flat and grow in a corridor,
yeah,
the deer hate it because they can't see anything. They hear things, but they can't see where it's coming from. And so they naturally hate it.
Yeah.
And then if you're doing it right, you can set it up so birds can come in and hit those rodents that are eating things more easily. But it's volume. And also being appropriate, like us trying to grow white potatoes in the soil right now would be a fool's errand. You know what I mean? You got to grow what grows in your bioregion in the season that it grows. So squash may do really, really well in certain times of the year, and other times the monsoon arrives and then everything gets so wet and flooded that you get hit with pests because the plant's essentially drowning. You know, it really just depends on your season, your pattern, and what you're working with, and doing what's appropriate, because some plants, like you said, the bioregion make all the difference.
Yeah. So, Larry, I'm going to give you a resource, and anybody else here that wants to know this, can you give us a quick summary of biochar? It's a deep subject. I have a 3-hour seminar that's free on YouTube. Just go to YouTube and search for Jack Spirko, S-P-I-R-K-O, biochar, and you can watch that whole thing, because we're at 2.5 hours and we need to wrap up. But biochar is basically charcoal that's made in a specific way, crushed and applied to the soil in combination with nutrients. That's as far as we're going to go today. Thoughts on polywania or whatever hell that is on regenerative sandy soils? I don't know that plant, Matt. So
I just have to remind myself of what plant that is.
I've never heard of it. I'll be honest. We'll skip that and go to another one of Matt's questions.
I think this is the miracle tree thing that people talk about.
Do this one and I'll Google it for you while you answer this one. Same guy says, any tips on getting rid of cow itch vine or lantana roots? Do you lock up or?
No. I was just reading it on Polania. Any tips on how to get cow itch vine? And so regardless of what plant you're talking about that you want to get rid of, you got to identify how it breeds, right? So if it's a rhizome-based plant, you can spray it, you can kill it, you can do whatever you want above ground. It doesn't make a difference. If you have rhizome-based problems, you need to address it at the rhizome. And so there are these handy-dandy little carts now that you can buy that allow you to walk through your garden and inject steam and kill them at the root level. So steam's an old technology. You know, we're steam cleaning things in our homes all the time, right?
Yeah. Well,
I don't know. I don't. But people do. So it's not as crazy technology. This is something very simple, very easy to do. Just remember, steam burns. And you can kill these plants and in situ very, very easily. So if you have a problem plant, you literally can go deal with it very pinpoint, very precise, kill it where it lives, and kill those root zone rhizome issues. And the heat from steam is actually great because lactic acid bacteria is stimulated by heat. So it's not going to be a detriment to your soil. And it's something that's super easy to do. It's really about immediately switching. You kill it, And then
you're from it twice before it comes back.
Right, right.
I will also say I've never seen any invasive species stay a problem if you can do it based on size and everything else with properly grazed pasture. I don't care what it starts out with. If you properly graze it, proper rotational grazing, high intensity grazing, everything eventually falls in line. And I've seen people say they were, but when you look at how they're grazing, but no, you're not doing it right. Like if you're grazing the way Alan Savory does, if you're grazing the way Greg Judy does, whatever your problematic plants are will eventually go away. I know that sounds too simple, but it's true.
And you can do it even with chop and drop, you know, like you could just cut the top of it and keep going. I've done this with certain, Scotch broom. I've had Scotch broom 6 feet tall. If they're at trees, you know, cut them at their base, sprayed more acidic and fungal based compost tea over the whole area, and then had all their stumps turn fungal and rot in place.
Hmm.
And then it turned into this beautiful pasture for grazing because we wanted to set it up for grazing. And so we can reclaim these areas. We can take them back from the brink, from degradation, by simply following one of these patterns and one of these protocols. It can be slower or it can be faster. It can be very aggressive or it can be very gentle. But they all work. That's the amazing thing about our work, and the reason you can interview me and interview Steven and interview Chris, is that nature has provided so many different ways, so many different expressions for doing the same thing. That's why, you know, in this book I feature, you know, Chris Trump's work. I feature, you know, deep insights from Steven Razor. The new edition of this is going to have more from Steven. And I feature, you know, Joel Salatin in here. I feature Elaine Ingham. I feature all these incredible people because we stand on the shoulders of all the giants. And it's that menu option that Jack's talking about creating in his course. He's like, well, I have to go through all these different things, these 50 different options, so that you actually can make an informed decision. And we have choice. We have our own unique way of doing it open to us. You can do it your way, but as long as it's one of nature's ways, you know what I mean, it'll work out.
Yep.
And that's the incredible thing about this, is you can do it different and it will work.
Yeah. Rachel says, can Matt be on the expert panel? Well, that's up to Matt.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you know how my expert panel works, Matt. People send in questions to me. I forward them to my panel members. They record an answer 7 minutes or less, and we play them on the Thursday shows. So
okay.
That's an open invitation we can talk about later if you want to.
I'm going to work up to that.
if I get two a month out of somebody, they get to stay. If I don't, then they get cut. Some people are pikers. Beth Risman says, can I add labs to my 20-gallon hydroponic tank to help aphids and spider mites? How much per gallon, if not any other suggestions? I grow edible flowers vertically indoors for my microgreen business.
You definitely can do that. How much and the rate and all of that, that's going to be Steven Raisner.
He'll help
convert you from hydroponics to aquaponics and help you improve even further. So I would highly recommend Steven Raisner's aquaponics course. Potent Ponics is his company. He is phenomenal in this space, and he's that beautiful combination of creative-minded and engineer-minded. He can speak and think in both. And so he's got amazing solutions for all sorts of setups. So I highly recommend asking Steven. He's here in the comments, maybe still live with us, but he's also has his website to check out.
And I'll just add on that real quick with the idea of moving to aquaponics, in that a lot of times people don't want to do aquaponics inside, especially if you're doing it like in your house. Because if you're doing larger systems, there can be some odor. 20 gallons is not a big system. Man, you could have a beautiful fish tank with like Basmati rainbows or something in it and run that system. And things like lab and all. If you do the thing Steven teaches, one of the things people have a problem with aquaponics is they think, well, then I can't really add anything. There's plenty of stuff you can add. Lab's a perfect example. I've been using the curd that comes from making lab to feed my fish since I met Steve, right? And so they're getting the lab, but they're also getting fed, you know, using a little bit of rice and milk to make the lab. And so, and what I've noticed with the lab, with the fish, is like fish fight with each other. I don't care what kind they are. When you stock the density necessary for aquaponics, an aquaponics system is overstocked and overfiltered by nature. So fish are much more aggressive toward each other in those large stockings. Well, so you end up with these wounds and they get this funky shit on them and these funguses. If you start putting lab in that, he's right. It all goes away. So I would definitely check in with Steve on that. Beth, I agree with Matt on that. Other Matt says, thoughts? Okay, he's asking again about the Paula Wanya, which it is a Chinese empress tree, Matt. Just call it what it is.
Right.
Yeah. Using your word, Matt.
So there's no all there's not much
word instead of redneck word.
So there's a whole bunch of these trees that like different groups put out as like the tree that will change everything. There's a miracle tree. And so I don't think that there's one tree that's going to change everything. And in fact, I think that what we need is more native trees. Like we need to like have push back the juniper. We need to have the oak forest come back. We need to like favor the things that are here. Oak is one of the most important plants in North America, and it is not given place. It is not valued. It is such good wood for so many things. I mean, not even going into how many things it's great for, but I wouldn't say necessarily Paulownia is any better than, you know, an oak. And I wouldn't think of them as like fixing a sandy soil. I would fix the soil and not like think about like a plant, a tree or something going to do it for me. You know what I mean? No, we got to actually diagnose your soil, address your soil. And if you want things to be done quick, you want annuals.
Yes.
Trees are takers for 20 years.
Yeah.
Forests, they don't give back. They got to grow. They got to embody all that nutrition. And then when they've reached their maturity, then they give back in huge amounts. Totally. Right. It's great. But the reality is if we want to build our soil, you're going to be working with mostly annuals or things that you terminate. You may set up perennials or trees and stuff around that area while you're developing it. That'll help. You know, trees around a 1 acre field increases yield by 14 to 16%. It's doable and it's cool and it's awesome, but that's not really going to change your soil quickly. You
right.
know, you need to be adding things to that soil that are like compost. You need to be at rock dust, maybe. You need to be maybe biochar. And then the biology, those things are going to make the difference, not a particular kind of tree.
And I know this guy, he's on small acreage, but acreage, it's not, you know, suburban. And so the first thing that springs to my mind, if you can do it, and he travels and the person he works with travels there. So you may not be as doable, but as grasses, forbs, and cattle, right? This is sandy soil in Texas, properly grazed system, and you're kind of moving then from an annual-based grasses and forbs. Eventually, any graze system is going to move primarily to a perennial, but you're still in grasses and forbs. And in that kind of soil, it seems crazy because you think, well, grass, you know, it's so dependent on moisture. But as you success grasses and forbs into that, you're ending up with some of these native species here in Texas that have roots that'll go down 15 foot. Right. And when you're at 15 foot, you're pretty freaking drought resistant even in central Texas at that point. And you have depth of soil to work with there. And so I would look to something like that. They also have like a giant tortoise from what David, my friend David tells me, like that acts like a cow. Right. Like maybe any more of those. I don't know, but they'll literally like 300 pounds. They'll break fences if you don't build them right for them. And they, in our climate, they need a place to go in winter to stay warm. They need like a fake burrow with a heater. But they're like some kind of Egyptian tortoise or Indian tortoise or some shit. you know, that people buy when they're this big and they think they're cool. But you can get big ones for free because once it gets to, it's like the size of half a Volkswagen, they want to give them away. David's trying to talk me into putting one here just to grace the east pasture or the west pasture. But I think grazing systems, when you start getting out past garden size, like some sort of animal integration, that's like my property won't support cattle and I don't want to deal with goats and it's really not ideal for sheep. So that's why I have birds. I think that once you move past an acre or two, if you really want restoration, you've got to do some sort of animal integration or it's going to take a lot longer. I mean, I just honestly believe that.
And just to finish the thought on that, I don't think it's a bad permaculture tree. You know what I mean? Okay. Having your mix. I mean, there's fodder leaves, it's nectar for bees. It's good wood. It has usage. You know what I mean? But I don't think it's one of those silver bullets. And I think there's a lot of advertisements online for like the miracle tree. It grows to the size of a full tree in 3 years.
Yeah.
Like, wow. Yeah. You know,
look what Jeff does in the desert with trees like that. Like he uses a lot of like trees that grow here natively, like mesquite, right? Because they'll do well in Jordan. But what are they doing with that tree? They are pruning it to a specific size. They're using it to create shade alleys and they are constantly recycling the organic matter into compost or into mulch. They're not just planting the tree and letting it do its thing. So if you're recycling it, if you're chopping and dropping and boy, in our climate, you better time that right. Because if you chop and drop in summer, you'll kill the freaking tree, right? But I've never been impressed with that particular tree, honestly. There's a lot of native species that will do very well here. And then there's a lot of native productive species. So it's always amazing to me, like the person in Texas is trying to grow an orange that you can grow down near the Mexican border. And then the person in Indiana is trying to grow a pecan. And the person in Central Texas isn't growing pecans, right? And like, so everybody wants what they can't have. Everybody wants something exotic. Everybody wants to import something. And I have no problems. I'm not a native Nazi or anything. But I think if you have a perfectly acceptable thing where you are, like Matt said, oaks or pecan, you have this both of them incredible timber trees, incredible wood tree, incredible biomass tree, and with oaks, if you pick the right variety, an incredible feed tree for livestock, except be careful with cows. Cows will kill themselves on acorns. But pigs, I mean, people spend $1,000 for a ham on an acorn finished pig in Spain. We got oaks everywhere. Let's cut that shit down and plant a friggin', you know, Egyptian tree or something. Like, work with what works, work with what grows, or analogs to what grows well where you are that give you something what like doesn't do well, like similar species or something like that. Anyway, we need a wrap, dude. It's like 2 hours and 40 minutes. We're almost 3 hours here.
Well, yeah, this is great. This is wonderful.
Well, we might could do this maybe once a month, maybe not this long or something like that, or once a quarter. I really like collaborating with you, and thank you for being with us today. You want to tell people how they can learn more about you, get your book, take your courses, all that stuff?
Yeah, if you go to my website, thepermaculturestudent.com, you can find these books. There's a pop-up, sorry.
That's all right.
And so you can go to my website. I've got tons of books on there. These books, Regenerative Soil, Regenerative Soil Microscopy, they're also, you know, on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all that, or wherever your country is that they have book selling, it'll probably be there. But if you want it on sale, you want, you know, free U.S. shipping, come to my website, check it out. And we also have courses that every book has a course that accompanies it. I have a master's degree in education. I'm a former professional educator, and now I just write curriculum and run online courses and help people all over the world. So if you need help with your soil, if you've got questions about soil science, or if you want to make this your thing, check it out.
And real quick, for those that don't know me until today, because you come from Matt's side of the house, I have a website called thesurvivalpodcast.com. If you don't want to type all that crap in, you can go to tspc.co. This is episode 3520 today. So we have over 3,000 episodes that we've done covering stuff like this and all over the map with entrepreneurship, lifestyle design, preparedness, etc. Use the search function. If you want to learn more about the type of composting I do, check out homefoodsystems.com. Right now there's two courses there. We're about to introduce our third. One of the courses is on bioreactor composting. It's only $40, guys, so it's not expensive. Also, if you just want to get a feel for the type of teaching that we do there, you can take a course called Principle-Based Permaculture Design. It's a 5-lesson course. It is a full course. I didn't cheap out on it, even though it's free. There's an exam certificate at the end of it, et cetera. So if you want to, like, get your feet wet and see if it's worth listening to a redneck farmer, try that course. We haven't had a single student that took it on either one of them with a negative thing to say, so we must have done something right. In the bioreactor course, you'll get a lot of the science geek stuff at the beginning and then a lot of the how-to as we move into it. And if you've looked at what Dr. Johnson does and says, well, I know how to make a bioreactor, you had to make his bioreactor, which I do as well. I made it so that the average person in a backyard or a small homestead could do it without any special equipment, no templates, no welding, no nothing, and no hauling shit 6 feet in the air to get it in there. And Matt can tell you it works. He's seen it. And yeah. I think that I want to put in something at the end here. You see a lot of things that people like Dr. Johnson do, or that Matt does, or I do, or all these other people do. And the natural instinct of human is to change it. I am full on with change. I do it all the time. Please understand what the person did and why they did it before you modify it. Because I've seen a lot of bioreactors 1 year in, pulled apart, the whole center's compost, the whole outside's, you know, unbroken down material. I'm not going to get into here at the end why that happened. I'll just say that if you understood what he did in the first place, that wouldn't have happened, right? And when we're making compost and some of the things that Matt's talking about and Steven talk about, like, you can't just look at it. That's why Matt uses a microscope. Like, just because it's broken down doesn't mean you've done it right, right? Like, that's stage one. At least you got that far. But there's a lot that goes into this. And, you know, I'll say, even though I sell courses, there's nothing I teach that you couldn't dig through 3,600 episodes and learn. I just put it in that format so it's easier for somebody that wants this one thing. And I try to keep it inexpensive because I do not believe in the secreting of knowledge. I believe that it is too dire a situation we're in for us not to make this stuff available. But we charge for courses because, God, I know you know, Matt, there's a lot of work that goes into it. It really is. To put it in that format, you know, and, you know, you end up with you start off, it's going to be a short course. You end up with a 20-page, you know, outline for the course. And then you got to build the course. And then you got to build the exams to make sure the student got what they're looking for. But, hey, man, thanks for being with us today. And, guys, check out Matt's stuff. If you're on my channel and you've never subscribed to Matt's YouTube, just search YouTube Matt Powers, and I'll have links in the audio notes and all as well. But get over there and subscribe to his channel. And if you're on Matt's side, come on over and subscribe to the Duck Farmer. You might learn something. Take care, Matt. Thanks for being with us today.
Have a great one, everyone.
I'm gonna bail you out, just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you'll